Good morning, members. I would also like to comment on what you're doing. Members, let us start with this meeting. I'd like to say good morning to each and every one. The IT people are not here at the moment, because we were supposed to set up everything for the department. But I think each and every one has the presentation. Is that correct? Have we got the presentation in front of us? Five. So while we are waiting on IT, you know, to arrive, I think we can start with the presentation. With those few words, I would like to welcome the Department of Basic Education to this very important meeting today on the annual report of the department itself for 2011-2012. And I would like to extend a special welcome to the DG, you know, for your presence, and even the rest of the department, because we have all our senior officials here today, led by the DG himself. And to the members, I would like to welcome you present too. As I said before, our meetings are always very full, and we normally record the highest attendance when it comes to the Basic Education Portfolio Committee meetings. And we have other persons present here today too, like guests, because everyone is normally here to listen to education, because we know it's a constitutional imperative, and that education, basic education, is very near to each and everyone's hearts. Before we hand over to the DG, Llewellyn, are there any apologies, please?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, apologies have been received from Honorable Mushwana, Honorable Skosana, Honorable Khanyaho, and Honorable Dudley. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that. Any apology from the department?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, we have an apology which was submitted in writing for the Minister of Basic Education. Her physician has put her on sick leave. And then an apology from the Deputy Minister of Basic Education. There's a cabinet meeting this morning that he has to attend. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for that. I saw the apology. The apology from the Minister is in writing. It's with our, and one is copies with myself, with the committee secretary, and then the others with you. And I think we're going to note those apologies. DG, I would like to hand over to you that you can make a presentation on your report itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. We're presenting on the annual report of the Department of Basic Education for the period 2011-2012 as is part of our statutory obligation and in keeping with the oversight function performed by the National Assembly. It's always critical at this point to recognize that in speaking to the annual report, we are speaking about the mandate of the Department of Basic Education, and we're speaking by a mandate determined or demarcated, delineated by our vote, i.e., what have we done with the money voted or appropriated for the Department of Basic Education? However, given what the Honourable Chair said about education, people are always interested in the wider sector, and therefore it becomes always unavoidable that issues related to the wider sector impact on this discussion and report, and vice versa. The critical thing, though, to bear in mind is that indeed, in terms of the requirements I've just referred to, the presentation relates to the mandate and the budget that was expended by the Department of Basic Education, i.e. that which was appropriated for the Department of Basic Education. We will, however, endeavor to engage on issues that honorable members may want to raise related to the sector as a whole. But I think increasingly, honorable chairperson, over the last few reports we've made in relation to our strategic plans and our annual financial statements, we have attempted to ensure that what the DBE does impacts on the sector as a whole, i.e., the way in which we spend the money appropriated to us must in some way give expression to our function of steering the sector. And therefore, you cannot separate what we do and what the sector does. So that's what we've attempted to do. It's not an easy thing, and as we go along, we'll speak about that, about how our efforts and our activities would find an impact in what's happening in the provinces. Because as we know, those lines and the connections between what we do and the provinces would be mediated by a whole range of things, many of which we've spoken about, issues related to intergovernment relations and the challenges around concurrency. But, honourable members, if you go to the next slide, after the cover slide, this presentation is made up of the background, the role of the DBE, the overview of the service delivery environment, our program performance, then we look at conditional grants, provincial budget monitoring and support, and our annual financial statements. And you'll see from this framework that it deals very much with the DBE's mandate. If you go to the next slide, it's just the header slide, background and organizational context, and then the following slide carries the heading background organizational context, and it starts with a legislative mandate. This is important. It's important, we know it for a long time, but increasingly over the last year, 2 years, last few months, the question of the role of the DBE has come into sharp focus because, you know, there's been a lot of interest in the sector, but in particular, there's been a lot of interest around the interventions, and therefore, the statutory function of the DBE has always featured very much and is a subject of increasing discussion in public and in the legislatures. But NEPA inscribes into law the policies of the National System of Education as a function of the DBE, monitoring responsibilities of the Minister of Education, as well as formal relations between national and provincial. It sets in place certain institutions like the Council of Education Ministers and the Heads of Education Departments Committee. These are not just structures that sit. These are institutional mechanisms to ensure intergovernment relations are held and to give expression to concurrency. So when we talk about monitoring, this is a key vehicle through which monitoring and coordination happens. It's a statutorily defined institution. I should add that many other departments have what they call MINMACs, technical MINMACs, and political MINMACs. Ours was definitely the first, but one of the few, that's captured in statutes, these intergovernment institutions. NEPA therefore makes provision for the formulation of national policy in general and further education and training, and then curriculum assessment, language, and quality assurance. NEPA embodies the principle of cooperative governance. Now, this is legislation that started many years ago, but as the years progressed, we understood better what it is that needed to be done to ensure that the sector works more strongly. And in the last period since 2009, we've embarked on specific activities that try to strengthen how the national department coordinates improvements in the sector. If you go to the next slide, covered the fact that our function is to look at policy norms and standards, and then monitoring and evaluation. It is informed by system performance, and it's become increasingly necessary that the DBE performs a more active steering role, given our experiences over the last few years. What have we done now to respond to these challenges? We've got stronger performance monitoring and evaluation by DBE and a number of other departments, National Treasury. DPME is a new institution created, ministry and department created after 2009, and the AG. We've got direct interventions like the workbook, ENA, a CD. We've got fiscal measures like conditional grants. It's been around for a while, but we're strengthening those. We've got monthly provincial budget monitoring reports. We've got, for the first time, a clear sector plan, which coordinates that which we seek to do by way of activities, but also it sets targets, a common set of targets with a province-specific definition of what those targets are. Quarterly meetings by the minister with district managers and the establishment of the planning and delivery oversight unit. If you go to the next slide, it looks at the overview of the service delivery environment, and the following slide then goes into detail. It's headed overview of the service delivery environment for 2011-12. The first sentence there starts with, during 2011-12, the service delivery environment of the education sector included 12 million learners in ordinary schools and independent schools who attended 25,851 schools, served by 420,000 educators. That's the size of the sector currently. There were at some point about 27,000 schools. The reduction is accounted for by the fact that many schools were small schools, they were unviable schools, and therefore needed to be rationalized. Also, as a result of demographic shifts, some schools became much bigger, and that explains the declining number of schools. In addition, what happened in the period under review or just prior to the beginning of the 2011-12 financial year, the Cabinet invoked Section 101B on the Eastern Cape, and then on 5th December 2011, Cabinet announced Section 101B intervention in Limpopo. These were two new developments which dramatically expanded the mandate of the Department of Basic Education, and it required us to embark on a task for which there was no precedent and for which we were not equipped or funded for. And that was a significant development in the period under review, and we'll speak about that as well. These interventions focus on financial and supply chain, the failure to deal with excess educators, overexpenditure, the non-delivery of learning and teaching support materials, and other areas where the service delivery of education was affected. This, honourable members, placed considerable strain on the DBE's capacity. It required re-engineering of the work of the DBE as we went along. You couldn't submit a new organogram or anything like that. You needed to function with your existing organogram and your existing budget, and you needed to deploy your staff, including myself as DG, to deal with these matters that came up unanticipated. Just to run one provincial department is a huge task. In fact, the size of a provincial department is much, much bigger than ours. The budget is much, much bigger than ours. And what we needed to do was to step in the next day, literally in each instance. We were told, and the next day we had to step in with plans and so forth, and step into an environment that was dysfunctional. We didn't go into a working, going concern, enterprise that was functioning properly. We went into a dysfunctional enterprise with no notice going in overnight. So this was a major development in the period under review, which preoccupied the energy of the department. Also, given its newness, a lot of the effort that we had to embark on was unfamiliar to us, and therefore we had to respond on the move, so to speak. If you go to the next slide, you will see that for the reporting period, the DBE continued to consolidate its advances. What was important to us, and what Minister Motsekga emphasized constantly, every meeting. She made it a mantra, which she continues to up to today, is that we must focus on the interventions, given their importance and given the seriousness of the challenges that we found in those two provinces. However, in doing that, we cannot sacrifice or compromise the mandate of the DBE. The mandate of the DBE continues. It is extremely important, as I've indicated in the background, and therefore we needed to continue to focus on that. And she made sure that we were driven to continue this focus on our strategic objectives, in particular the triple T's, teachers, text, and time, the implementation of the new CAPS, the planning and implementation for the annual national assessments, expanding the workbooks program, improving infrastructure, and looking at various strategies for the improvement of learner performance. These things we continue to do in the year. And yes, it's trained our people and our resources and continues to do that. But we continue to ensure that we maintain that balance on a constant basis. Sometimes it's not easy. You have a plan to do certain things in the sector. There's a huge, urgent matter that arises in one of the Section 100 provinces, and you have to shift gear immediately, like the morning you arrive at the office. This happens on a daily basis, 7 days a week. But we've had to try to ensure that we maintain that balance. So key systemic improvements were consolidated around these strategic interventions for the period 2011-12. And fortunately, we had the action plan, and that helped to frame all our activities, including the interventions. If you go to the next slide, you will see that in areas of access, we report here from an independent survey of the 2011 General Household Survey. So this survey is conducted in 2011. The results only became available recently. But it tells us what progress we've made, measured at the point the survey was taken in 2011. And what it says here is that 85% of five-year-olds attend educational institutions, from 39% in 2002. This is ECD, or grade R, in terms of terminology. And that is a very important achievement. We were told, we agreed in the sector, in terms of the executive, the cabinet, the legislatures, we were told that ECD is important. And concerted effort was put into the rollout of ECD in terms of funding and in terms of provision. And that achievement is huge in a very, very short space of time. If you go to the next bullet, 99% of 7 to 15-year-olds attend an educational institution. In terms of the Constitution, attendance for that age group, 7 to 15, is compulsory, and a figure of 99% in terms of the Constitution is considered to be full access to education in terms of its universal measurement. However, we're still not happy with that 1% that's not accounted for. And that 1%, a large portion of the 1%, is children who are disabled, and again it speaks to the effectiveness of our inclusive education access and strategies. But it also may speak to very far-flung rural areas where we need to make sure that we reach children. If you look at it on the flip side, we've got to accept that the largest proportion of children in South Africa are poor. A large proportion of them come from rural areas, far-flung rural areas. Therefore, to achieve a figure of 99% in the context of our country, and you add to it inequality, is a huge achievement. It's huge by any measure. This figure is a figure that is applied or is relevant to highly industrialized countries. Definitely not poor countries, definitely not poor countries with high income inequality. So again, it's a huge achievement. 93% of 16-year-olds attend educational institutions. That figure suggests that they stay in school at least up to the age of 16. Now, we know that around about 15, 16 is where we have huge dropouts that we can see in the schooling system. However, if you look at the General Household Survey, it says that 86% of 17-year-olds attend an educational institution. Now, 17-year-olds are like sort of grade 11, grade 12. Some of them may be in grade 10. This is the FET that we're talking about, 86%. So some of them are in the FET band, some of them are repeaters, some of them are in FET colleges. So it's important to contextualize them, the visual image one gets about the numbers dropping in the FET. According to this survey, the majority of 16-year-olds, overwhelming majority, 86%, a high measure by international standards, are attending an educational institution. Then 18-year-olds, 74% of 18-year-olds attend education institutions, but 26% do not. Of those that do not attend, 35% have completed grade 12. So again, yeah, 74, let's look at it the other way, 26% do not attend an education institution of 18-year-olds. Remember, we often get the figure that those who start grade 1, very few end up in grade 12. It's true, very few pass grade 12, or too few pass grade 12. But let's look at those attending education institutions. Only 26% of 18-year-olds are not in an education institution. Of those 26%, 35% are not attending because they've already completed their schooling, grade 12. So the figure is less than what the 26% suggests. But 74% of 18-year-olds are in an education institution. So again, it's important to draw the distinction between dropouts / those who are in education institutions, which seems very high, through independent surveys, and then to compare that to actual success rates in grade 12. Now, we are definitely not happy with the success rate in grade 12. We want to increase that. It is growing. But clearly, in terms of participation, it is high, and it's generally higher than what public perception seems to suggest. If we go to program performance, which is the next slide, honorable members, here we look at the program structure of the DBE, and we give an indication of the targets here. For administration, we had 8 targets, and we achieved 4 were exceeded, and 4 not achieved. Curriculum policy, 8 were exceeded, 6 not achieved. Teacher education, 6 were exceeded, 3 were not achieved. Planning quality, 5 were exceeded, 10 not achieved at the level of the target. And in social responsibility, 11 targets, 7 of which we exceeded, and 4 achieved less than the target. Now, I'm going to go very quickly, Honorable Chair, because I know that time is of the essence and this presentation is quite voluminous because it is the annual report. Honorable members would have gone through the annual report, no doubt, other supporting documents and the presentation that we sent. So I'm going to go through it quite quickly because I want to focus on important areas rather in my presentation. Very quickly, highlights on this slide. I'm on the slide, highlights and achievements, policy area, human resource management. Here we had a new organizational structure. Key posts were filled in the department, the CFO, Deputy Director General as well. In response to national attrition, we put in place a development plan and professional and personal development plan, and we had training and development in the department. If you go to the next slide, we had 2 high-level resignations. That is the CEO of NIDU, and the head of the Planning and Delivery Oversight Unit in the period under review. All in all, it was a relatively peaceful year, no strikes in the department or the sector as a whole. In the next slide, curriculum implementation and development. The caps we've reported on quite a bit. I will not go into this slide at all. If you go to the next slide, you will see that in preparation for implementation in grades 4 to 6 in 2013, all district officials responsible for teacher training and support in these grades were oriented to the changes of CAPS. We did the same last year. The Eastern Cape orientation was scheduled to be done in May. The reason why we report like this to be done in May is because our cutoff point for this report is end of March 2012. So even though we're now in October, we're still saying to be done in May. It was done in May. A total of 968 district officials were taken through the orientation program, and then we established a national training team to ensure that the orientation happens properly. In the next slide, it speaks about the CAPS documents being distributed to school, other support documents, question and answer booklets, self-study guides, CDs, DVDs, etc., assessment item banks, and an additional 3,500 assessment item bank files were printed and distributed to schools offering the senior phase. So this is all supporting the implementation of the CAPS. If you go to the next slide, in terms of LTSM, in 2011, a total of 23 million grade R to 6 workbooks were distributed in language and mathematics to 18,854 public schools in 9 provinces, and here we covered all quintiles. In 2012, schools were informed that the distribution of workbooks in an effort to improve delivery would now be expanded to include grades 9, R to 9, and were distributed to the target schools. Proof of deliveries for volume 1 and 2 workbooks was provided as follows: 98.74% of grade R to 9 volume 1, 97.25 of grade 1 to 9 volume 2, and 97.36 of FET, physical science and mathematics supplementary books were distributed. We also completed the grades 1 to 3 and grade 10 national catalog for textbooks aligned to the CAPS and released it to the provinces. If you go to the next slide, still on LTSM, we, through the interventions that we embarked on, we managed to bring down the prices significantly. There's a framework for LTSM policy was developed. We've got a minimum school bag to ensure that we've got uniformity, and we improve coverage and we improve relevance of books throughout the sector. The national catalog was now implemented for the CAPS. Reading and literacy activity guide was developed. 2,600 schools were provided with library books, national guidelines for school library and information services, and an implementation plan was developed in collaboration with provinces. This is all to ensure that we have adequate LTSM, that we shift dramatically from the very low coverage this country had as recently as the 2006 or 7 assessments that were done. And you can already see the figures in the system where coverage has improved significantly. It hasn't made us many friends. To put it the other way, we've made a lot of enemies because we've brought down the price of individual books considerably. We've got proof of that. We can put it on the table where there's a dramatic reduction in the price of books that the state is paying for, and that in the process, for the same amount of rand, we're getting greater coverage. That's an important measure of value for money, indeed, in the system, because textbooks have been proven, confirmed by the CAPS, that unless you have good aligned textbooks for each child, you are not going to succeed in your delivery. We were spending a lot of money, but we were getting low coverage. This has helped us considerably to reduce costs and improve quality and improve coverage in the same time. If you go to the next slide, in terms of e-education, we developed agreements with partners like Telkom to cover schools. 9 provincial ICT resource centers were with the required infrastructure, laptops, etc., were developed. And then the digital classroom was developed to connect to the 9 centers as well. For the period under review, 3,900 educators were using and applying ICT in the classroom. 22,000 educators were trained, and 2,200 additional schools were connected to the ICT infrastructure and services. In terms of ENA, the first cycle of ENA was written in February 2011. Following the finalization of the ENA report in June 2011, work started on improving the utility of the data, quality, etc. We learned a lot of lessons from the first implementation of ENA, and those lessons were then incorporated into our planning for the second cycle of ENA. We got additional capacity to improve the credibility of the assessment tools and our rollout strategy. Test developers developed draft tests for grades 1 to 6, and these were submitted for moderation. We also piloted these assessment tools. ENA exemplars were developed and released to support the preparation for the second cycle of ENA. The results for 2011 National Senior Certificate reflected an increase in performance from 67.8 in 2010 to 70.2 in 2011. This figure was subsequently increased to 72.7 after the supplementary exam results were incorporated. The presentation is now on the screen. I'm on the second bullet there. The number of learners who qualified to enter bachelor's program came to 120,000 in 2011. Given the importance of physical science and mathematics, we set ambitious targets. The number of passes in mathematics came to 104,000 and to 96,000 in physical science. The number of candidates who sat for the matric exam in 2011 was 496,000, compared to 537. The decrease in enrollment contributed to the lower achievement of absolute numbers. Now, we know that we've been monitoring the declining numbers. The main explanation around which there's consensus by outside experts and our internal experts is that the reduction is shaped largely by the age of admission policy in grade one when this cohort started school. And that explains that figure. We, although continue to monitor it and to ensure that gatekeeping is not resulting in learners being excluded from grade 12. We therefore monitor, and this is the best way to monitor whether or not candidates are being excluded, is to look at the percentage of candidates who sit for the exam in grade 12 against the number in the age cohort of the population. So we generally say, how many have enrolled for matric as a proportion of the 18-year-olds in the population? I know there are 17-year-olds and 19-year-olds, it doesn't matter. But if you use that same measurement every year, you'll be able to tell whether people are being excluded or not. The reason why you use the age cohort is because that tells you whether, in fact, in the population, there's a decline. Now, we know in about 10 years or less, we are going to see a decline in numbers because there's been a huge reduction in fertility rates in South Africa. Fewer babies are being born. So you're going to see numbers coming down. That's why it's important to deal with that. Thank you. Okay, in terms of the assessments, a detailed technical report on the NSC exams was developed and distributed to all stakeholders. This is a very, very valuable diagnostic report, which is then used not only for setting the next papers, but for interventions to improve the grade 12 results and for teacher development. If you look at special needs, we coordinate the development of a South African Sign Language curriculum. English Afrikaans workbooks for numeracy and literacy were adapted to Braille. Inclusive education strategy was developed and used to contribute to the development of a national strategy on learner attainment. So educators for all learners. Guidelines for responding to learner diversity form part of the CAPS. No training by DBE took place on the identification and support of special needs. This was due to the prioritization of the implementation of CAPS in 2012. In 2011-12 financial year, was specifically set aside for the refinement and finalization of the screening, identification, assessment, and support tool, the CIAS tool, which is going to be used for training and for the implementation of White Paper 6 on inclusive ed. The framework for the refinement of CIAS was developed in November 2011. The rewriting of CIAS took place in 2012. So we've not been happy with our progress on inclusive ed, and you can see here that we've taken some critical steps to remedy that situation. We've got, as you know, the Integrated Strategic Planning Framework for Teacher Education, which provides a comprehensive plan. The provision of teacher training programs to teachers is the function of provincial departments, and the DBE plays a coordination role. Orientation for introduction of CAPS to 90,000 foundation phase and 60,000 grade 10 teachers were coordinated in conjunction with the PEDs. Further teacher development programs were coordinated with provincial departments in targeted priority areas. If you go to the next slide, we initiated our collaboration program with teacher unions. We've spoken about that. It's a very, very important program. And in the first year, we obviously anticipated teething problems, but it went quite well, and reported 21,306 teachers participated in CAPS orientation in this program. We also hosted a successful National Teacher Awards to increase the recognition of teaching as a profession, to validate those teachers who are working very hard, and to address the public perception where there's a tendency towards thinking all teachers are not working in the system. Those National Teacher Awards went quite well. We got very positive feedback from the public at large, who then refocused on the fact that there are many, many excellent teachers out there performing sterling work under conditions that may not be very easy. Teacher supply and utilization, as of the end of December, 1,822 teachers, 76% of the 2010 graduates had been appointed, and of these, 82% were under 30 years old. The percentage is slightly higher than 2010. So we're getting somewhere in terms of improving the appointment of graduates from our Funza Lushaka program. The number of qualified teachers aged 30 and below entering the public service as teachers for the first time during the past year, overall target of 6,200 was exceeded. This is important because we know we've got an aging teacher population, and we have to bring in younger teachers if we're going to avoid what's called the demographic bulge, where at a sudden point in time, we have a large percentage of teachers suddenly retiring. The target of Funza Lusaka bursaries were exceeded. Teacher supply during the period under review, we developed a post-provisioning model that will assist provinces to generate staff establishments. We worked with a number of provinces to assist in implementation. 65% of learners in classes with no more than 45 learners. This is evidence of classroom backlogs that persist. If you look at school management, a number of principals participated in the advanced certificate. 8,400 schools were visited by IQMS, and we established 12 TC committees in more than 3,000 schools. If you go to the next slide, the SGB elections in March 2012 were held throughout the country, full participation of parents, overseen by the IEC. So this is a major success. We believe there's still a lot that we need to do around school governance, but the fact that we held successful elections shows that things are getting better, and there are many school governing bodies that are functioning effectively, although we still got to continue to improve it to a point where the majority function effectively. Partnerships with community, we launched the NetLeg Accord, and these partnerships continue. If you go to the next area, which is school funding, a request aimed at securing additional funding for implementing the school funding norms within the revised Grade R policy framework was made to Treasury and improved for the expansion of Grade R in 2013-14 and 2014-15 periods. Funding requests was made to ensure provinces could fund no-fee schools and to offer certain fee-charging schools the option to be voluntarily declared and funded as no-fee schools. Funding was consequently made available by the National Treasury for the equalization of the allocation of no-fee schools in the 2013 and 2014-15 period. So those are important developments. Amendments to the National Norms and Standards for School Funding by updating the National Table of Targets for School Allocation for 2012-13 have been approved and gazetted. An effort was placed in DCIS aimed at emphasizing under what conditions parents automatically comply for the exemption of fees. 78% of learners in public schools were accommodated in more than 20,000 no-fee schools. It's important to emphasize that point. According to our quintile system, 60% of the learners are deemed to be poor, very poor. In quintile 4, they are less poor. In quintile 5, majority of learners are considered to be least poor. However, in terms of no-fee schools, 78% of the learners are accommodated in no-fee schools. That's a major achievement. However, that only works provided provinces are providing the no-fee allocation on time and to the right amount. We know in some provinces, like in Limpopo, that didn't happen. because of the financial problems. And on intervention, this was one of the urgent matters we had to deal with to ensure that these schools, these poor schools, get their allocations and get their full allocations. So aside from that, though, the number of learners incorporated is a huge number. And if you look at the school nutrition program, you'll see the figures are in a similar area in terms of what we provide to poor learners. The national target allocation for 2012, which caters for non-personal and non-capital expenditure, was increased to 960 rand per learner for schools in quintile 1. School infrastructure, HR strategy to address capacity constraints for infrastructure delivery was developed. This is in response to the poor spending rates for infrastructure. And it was agreed by Treasury that an amount of 10 million rand could be allocated to each province to address capacity constraints. Indeed, in the few months preceding today, we've had a number of provinces, I think the majority of provinces now, have made submissions to us and have granted permission for them to use this money to appoint technical expertise in infrastructure development, engineers, quantity surveyors, etc. So that's a major development to address a problem that we've been aware of, that the AGs picked up, that the reason for under-expenditure in infrastructure is because of a lack of technical capacity in the area of both expertise, but also in the area of contract management. And that's what this 10 million rand is intended to address. It's 10 million rand for each province. We recognize that in most provinces, that capacity didn't exist. Also because many provinces had been working with public works. So the assumption was that public works will have the capacity and that the education department's function was simply to say, these are our learner numbers, that's where we think we need the school. But beyond that, there wasn't much other capacity. We're changing that completely. It's not a quick fix. You can't do this thing overnight, but we're getting there. The other issue is that, and we found this when we introduced the concept of CFOs many, many years ago. I just come into the public service at that time. And education was one of the first. And we said each provincial education department must have a CA or equivalent or close to a CA. And the moment we made that determination, soon after health followed and so forth, there was suddenly a shortage of these people in the country because everybody was looking for them. And we then employed people without CAs, and even that became a shortage because all departments were now looking. Then with the PFMA kicking in, making it obligatory that each department needs a CFO, the demand increased tremendously. So the lady to my left here is a very, very scarce commodity in huge demand in the labor market. Similarly here now, the moment we said across the country we're increasing our infrastructure expenditure, a number of things kicked in. Demand went up and supply then became inflated, including skills. So now when we look for a civil engineer, it's very, very hard to get that civil engineer because the construction firms have got work. They need the civil engineers. We need the civil engineers. So all of us suddenly are scrambling around. A while ago, civil engineers were very easy to get. You advertise, a lot of them come. They even come help you with your houses. But these days it becomes very difficult because we've just suddenly increased the demand. But I think people will recognize that and respond to it. And in time we will get that capacity. But I'm simply saying it's not an overnight thing that can happen because we've suddenly increased demand. Guidelines for planning for school infrastructure and for boarding facilities were concluded and approved by the CEM. Standardized designs and cost models were developed and approved. A short-term technical assistance support was appointed to assess infrastructure plans and to assist provinces. This was established in DBE. The EIG, the Education Infrastructure Grant, at the end of March 2012, PEDs had spent 93% of 5.254 billion of the adjusted grant of 5.678 million. It's 5,254 million. Sorry, that should have been a comma. School infrastructure then, there's been some progress in addressing school infrastructure issues since the commencement of the implementation of a CD. Honorable Chair, this has been an issue that we've spoken about here at appropriations and also a matter that the AG raised in the report and raised yesterday in their presentation in terms of underspending. During the 2011-12 financial year, the following infrastructure projects were implemented: 1,648 classrooms, 316 sanitation blocks, water supply to 63 schools, electricity to 540 schools, and fencing to 96 schools. However, delivery on school infrastructure remains a challenge. Some of the challenges include the following. Substantial variances existed in the cost of building schools across provinces, which is compounded by a lack of uniformity in provincial planning, budgeting, design, etc. This has been reported across the board, where in one province the cost of a classroom is a fraction of what it costs in another province, and this is a huge issue. The competency of contractors and consultants, the dispersed nature of the projects, a myriad of small contracts that are to be managed, inadequate project management, etc., has been a huge issue. In our country, we correctly say we want to support small contractors. And therefore, if you suddenly have to build a lot of schools, you have a lot of small contractors. But to manage each contract requires a high level of expertise and time. If you have a 1,000 such contractors, or 500, or 100 such contractors, it's a huge enterprise to do. You link that to poor skills and capacity, you're sitting with a huge issue. These are the things that we're working very hard to fix. Ongoing maintenance and operations are not receiving adequate funding and attention, and that causes huge problems in terms of fixing it up. The DBNI's quarterly engagement with district directors to advocate their contribution to the action plan. I'm talking about district development. The guidelines and organization of roles of districts were released, a national vision for education districts, and support to underperforming districts as well. In terms of the legal and legislative services, the DBE had 37 court cases in a period under review. 37. We're probably one of the most litigated departments, second to the police, I think. And that, as the chair said, that education is very important, close to people's hearts, and people out of genuine concern want to ensure that the constitutional provisions are being given expression. We also, in many cases, are litigated because of what's happening in the provinces, in a particular the two provinces under Section 100. Because of the intervention, we are automatically cited. In other instances, we are incorrectly cited, but largely it's about the Section 100 provinces. Copies of legislation were drafted. I'm not going to go into that. The needle bill and pregnancy regulations. International relations, we bilateral agreements with the People's Republic of China, Japan, United UNESCO, biennial conference the minister attended, United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. Karigure, a total of 39,000 volunteers, including 176 blind volunteers were contracted. 253 million was paid out in stipends, 3,600 volunteer supervisors, and a total of 2.8 million workbooks were supplied. 660,000 learners. Total number of learners enrolled, 95% of the learner assessment for portfolios have been completed, so this has been quite a successful program. In terms of learner well-being, about 8.8 million learners in 21,000 quintiles 1 to 3 schools were receiving a nutritious meal every day. That's 9 million learners in our country every day get a nutritious meal. This is a huge, huge enterprise. There are problems around procurement, etc., but the point is it's a huge enterprise. Independent surveys done, which is not annual measurements of targets, shows that the school nutrition program has made a positive impact on school attendance and the nutritional status of poor learners. Furthermore, every school you go to in a poor area, including the one we visited recently where the president handed over the school, we know that children go to the school over weekends and holidays in particular to get a meal. And unless you have school feeding during the holidays in that school, the children will not eat for that day. So this is a huge poverty alleviating intervention which has impact on the holistic development of the child, including the educational dimension of that development. 256,000 learners in Quintile 1 family schools underwent health screening. 902,000 learning and teaching support materials on sexual and reproductive health were delivered. 18,000 teachers were trained. 235 schools participated in the Care and Support for Teaching and Learning pilot program. 9,700 public ordinary schools participated in school sport leagues, and 8,000 public ordinary schools were linked to their local police stations. The Values in Education Training Manual distributed Bill of Responsibilities and the Social Cohesion Toolkit. Now, if you look at conditional grants, five conditional grants are allocated by the department during the period under review: HIV and AIDS Life Skills Program, NSNP, Denaledi, Technical Schools, Education Infrastructure Grants. In addition, the department received an allocation for the Backlogs Grant, which is the CD one, amounting to $700 million. Before conditional grants are transferred to provinces, the department ensured that all requirements in DORA, the Division of Revenue Act, are complied with, and that's the condition in which we operate. In terms of HIV and AIDS, a total of 291,000 learners and 462,000 parents and other stakeholders were reached. Peer education was done, training and development, care and support, learning and teaching support materials, 1.2 million sets of LTSM distributed to 13,000 primary schools. Monitoring and support, 8,000 selected schools were reached through monitoring and support visits. The challenges were that there was late approval of tender specs in Northwest and Western Cape to conduct the training activities, delayed payment of invoices for activities that have been conducted in Limpopo, had an impact on the final spending of the grant, and the utilization of the conditional grant for non-grant activities in Gauteng impacted on the spending rate. So these are the reasons why there was under-expenditure in HIV/AIDS. NSNP, the program was extended to Quintal 3 secondary schools. Vegetable gardens in schools increased from 5,900 to 7,100. 53 workshops were conducted in a partnership with Tiger Brands. Support for schools in Gauteng, Limpopo, KZN, and Western Cape concluded. In Denaledi, we supplied physical science, mathematics, life science, agricultural science, English textbooks and study guides, supplied mobile science labs and other equipment, provided teacher training, audio visuals, equipment, maths kits, and the challenges, though, included the late submission of monthly, quarterly, annual reports and business plans by province. The CEM has flagged the need to review some of these grants, Denaledi being one of them, the Technical School Recapitalization Program being another one. So we're reviewing whether, in fact, these grants, given the original intention, still have that relevance, and whether there are other priorities in education linked to our experience in the implementation of these grants, which may require a reformulation or re-engineering of these grants. So that is underway in the CEM currently. And as I indicated, it links to the technical secondary school recap. 23 out of 42 new workshops were built. 198 out of 247 existing workshops were refurbished. Equipment, machinery, tools were bought. 554 out of 558 technical school teachers were trained. The challenges, though, include delays in the development and approval of tender specs in the provinces. Irregular monitoring, collection of data and reporting resulted in the absence of information to detect early warning signals of underperformance, late approval of provincial and school business plans. So these are the problems that continue to plague the Technical Secondary School Recap Program. The Education Infrastructure Grant, a total of 39,000 projects were completed, including ablution facilities, classrooms, specialist rooms, water provision, mobile classrooms, and fencing. Challenges include, as I've indicated, insufficient capacity to deliver infrastructure. That's a big thing. But let me say that the major issue is insufficient capacity in the departments, provincial departments, the DBE as well, and we're trying to grow that. However, there's insufficient capacity in the private sector. If you look at the CD, we did a proper procurement through our implementing agent, DBSA. We screened the contractors, monitored the contractors, and most of the contractors have defaulted in terms of time. So the capacity of, and that's we made it available to the entire private sector. Anyone could bid. We had preferential criteria, of course. We ensured that BEE, in terms of the provisions, were complied with, but we tried to ensure that the province, the enterprises, the contractors from the province benefited for local economic development. So we opened it up to the entire private sector. But the capacity of the private sector is a huge problem in this area. So it's the public and private sector capacities that's a huge issue here that we've got to deal with. And you'll see when I speak later about underspending in a city, how that is arisen and how through the PICC that matter is being addressed. But furthermore, a lack of adequate reporting and monitoring. Large number of projects are at retention, i.e. they're not closed yet. They've been left open for a long time. Poor adoption of best practices across provinces and projects. A lack of capacity to maintain an infrastructure database. Something as fundamental as that. And then budget and monitoring. A budget standard exercise at the MTF period was undertaken throughout the 9 provinces. The focus was following on the evaluation of spending performance, etc., the implementation of audit action plans. PED's monthly expenditure reports were collected. Financial management support was provided. Policy compliance. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, we often read in various reports and in the media that the criticism is that we're not monitoring public expenditure by provinces. We said it before, and I say it again yesterday, that we monitor it on a regular basis. We compile reports, we assess the audit turnaround plans, etc. We compile reports and we report it to the Council of Education Ministers and the Heads of Education Committee. When I started, I indicated that these are not just structures that meet. These are institutional mechanisms for coordination and accountability. It is through those structures that the Minister presents to the MECs an assessment of financial performance in those provinces in terms of expenditure. They then respond and have to go back and do corrective measures. The next month, it's done again. So there's regular reporting on this matter and detailed reports are generated. In terms of challenges, in terms of infrastructure, we've indicated that a huge amount of money is required. Current projections are such that we don't have enough money to deal with the infrastructure backlog. In terms of the expenditure patterns there, I'm just going to flash this slide here. You will see the challenges of spending is really in the area of teacher, education, human resources there, in particular, though, planning, quality assessment, monitoring and evaluation, and that's where the infrastructure budget rests. In this slide here, you look at compensation of employees, 95%, goods and services, 91%, and then the others, the particular ones is buildings and other fixed structures, 11.4%, but overall a spending rate of 91.6%. Now, for reasons for deviation, administration, 6 million rand unspent, and this is because of the CPI fluctuations. So this is really a savings because CPI being lower than expected. Reasons for deviation, curriculum, policy, and support monitoring. Here we got an unexpenditure of 96 million, mainly due to the delay in procurement of Kari Gude. We've explained that with the AG's intervention, there was an issue about the way in which procurement was done through an external entity that was procured to implement Kari Gude. The AG raised with us after the beginning of the project. The first few years were fine, but then procurement was questioned. We then changed the procurement strategy and as a result to comply. And as a result of that, there were delays in procurement. And that is the irregular expenditure that you see on our annual financial statement. Delay in submission of invoices for the curriculum review project resulted in inability to finalize the process of processing of payments. Final invoices for the workgroup project were received at the end of the financial year. This is because we don't pay anything for the workbooks unless we've got a proof of delivery, i.e. a signed acknowledgement by the principal that the school books have been delivered, and those PODs are audited by independent auditors. If that process takes too long, we have a delay, and that's what happened there. And then the withholding of the final dinner lady grants to Limpopo due to low spending. Then in teacher education, 43 million unspent, mainly due to the resignation of external moderators in respect of the IQMS, and invoices in terms of the partnership with teacher unions that came in late, that still needed to be verified. We couldn't pay just on receipt. In terms of planning, and this is the infrastructure one, NIDU under expenditure is that the evaluators were appointed in the latter part of the year. Systemic evaluation, when we shift ENA, the expenditure was only going to happen this financial year as opposed to the last one. And then the school infrastructure backlog grant for the eradication of inappropriate structures. Spending was lower than projected due to capacity challenges experienced by the implementing agents and the contractors. This had an impact on the expenditure.
I know that you are not asking questions now, but if the DG could go, because something that I wanted to verify just quickly. The previous slide.
This one, yeah.
That amount, if it is correct, because that amount means a billion.
Yeah. It's a billion, yeah. It's a thousand million.
So that's correct, it's a billion.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
yeah. 1.017 billion. Okay. The procurement of implementing agents, this explains the chronology of what happened and the delays. We appointed implementing agents, and it took longer than expected. The negotiating IDT commenced in February 2011. However, in April 2011, when negotiations IDT were not concluded, it was indicated that DBSA should be used as the implementing agent. We then negotiated with them, and that started in April 2011. There were delays in the finalization of the MOA. Subsequently, DBE signed the MOA in June only, and DBSA submitted the implementation plan in 3rd August. So you can see that quite a bit of time went there. They planned to use private service providers to undertake the scoping exercise, which was crucial to determine the scope of work. This process of getting the PSPs to undertake the work had to be rescinded at the end of August because of a conflict of interest that was discovered between the companies bidding for the project support unit and the scoping exercise. DBSA then started a process to procure PSPs separately. And the slide explains the various processes that were embarked on. However, the procurement of contractors resumed on the 25th of October. It was after, on the 22nd of August, the process being halted because there was a dispute with contractors from the Eastern Cape who requested that we consider 6 GB instead of 7 GB. They felt that we're leaving out small contractors, and there was threats there of protests and so forth. But in the whole, we felt that we needed to support smaller companies, and therefore reopened the process, which resumed on the 25th of October and concluded in November for the 28 of the 50 schools and 22 of the 50 schools respectively. The tenders received were based on generic scope of work, and as a result of that, the amounts for the first 28 of the 50 and 22 schools were 711 million and 595 million. You will see that for 28 schools, it would almost have exhausted the entire budget. This then required that we negotiate and renegotiate, and as a result of that took time, but we managed to bring the amount down. If we just approved it at that time, we would have increased the cost per classroom tremendously through this project, which we didn't want to do. We then embarked on a process of looking at the risks and how we mitigate that risk. And you'll see in the risks there, the current program management and delivery experience is limited. And what we're doing here is to have a diversified delivery modality to reduce reliance and dependence on implementing agents. DBSA has low project maturity and capacity. We discovered that now. So we're having diversifying additional contract allocation will be dependent on competence. However, in fairness to DBSA, they're at a point now, having finished this first year, where they've got momentum, the contracts have been sorted and signed, they've employed the staff, so they are much better geared to move now. It's always difficult in the first year of a project of this nature, but we believe that they are also quite smooth in running now and other implementing agents. And Gola Trust are receptive and cooperative, but need the support and assistance of developing their systems. We'll use this allocation for 2011-12, their allocation to support the development of the systems. We established a relationship with IDT at the national level, and this will assist in the process in working in provinces. ESCOM, again there, we developed a reporting capacity and closer monitoring. PEDs, we're shifting allocations away from PEDs in the subsequent periods, adopting a range of procurement options in addition to traditional approaches. In terms of smaller CIDB grade contractors, we're having work packages that will allow for subcontracting and alternative delivery models there so that we ensure we keep them in. And then a range of Schedule 2 entities, we're expanding the range of delivery agents to reduce reliance on implementing agents. Let me also say that on infrastructure, we found that one of the challenges in Eastern Cape, when we call the contractors in and ask them why is it taking so long, they told us that because we came in so big with our expenditure, 50 schools, and the province was spending, and our health was spending, and roads and transport was spending, there was a huge pressure on supply. At some point, contractors couldn't get bricks in the province. They couldn't get skilled labor. The contractors we spoke to said they couldn't get supervisors after a while. Now, that's a lesson for us, that if you suddenly increase expenditure, the private sector has limited capacity. It can't suddenly come in. Some of them tender, not knowing that there's going to be a shortage of bricks. Others tender, knowing too that they may not have the equipment, but they tender in the process, because no one's ever been very strict with them with deadlines. We've now been very, very strict. We've called them to order, we've taken legal action, we've contract managed, and one contractor in particular, we've now terminated the contract. They've refused to leave the site. We've dealing with them through the courts to ensure that they vacate the sites. But this has been a huge problem in terms of capacity. The PICC, the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, has been formed in particular in response to these challenges about how demand, you know, can very easily exceed supply of the, and capacity of the private sector and how you manage that. What they've told us is, for example, if we have a problem with bricks in Eastern Cape, we can approach them so that they can look at how, through DTI, we can address a supply constraint for any material, including something like bricks. If you look at supervisory capacity, what can we do there? So those are issues that we're embarking on. However, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, the key thing here with matching demand from government with supply capacity of the private sector is that when government demand increases suddenly, it's very difficult for the private sector to respond because it's sudden. But also it's very difficult for the private sector to say, let's build capacity. They don't know there's going to be a guarantee that government's going to be spending. So what we're doing now is to say to the private sector, here's our multi-year plans. So if you're a private company, you know that if I invest in equipment and so forth, I know that there's going to be X amount of work in this country that I need to respond to. And that will help quite a bit. That's what the PICC is working on and we're working on as well. So all in all, we think that across government, including education, important lessons have been learned. The PICC have incorporated that. Minister Patel is working very closely with our minister. Reports have been presented to the PICC, which, as you know, is chaired by the President and the Deputy President. And we believe that we're on course now to accelerate quite dramatically the performance in relation to spending on infrastructure, both at the level of the province and at the level of the CD. In terms of social responsibility, 16 million unspent, no material variances in this program. It can't be unspent, there's no material variances. Okay, it's below the materiality figure. There's a materiality figure in auditing, which if you're below that figure, it's not a material variance. So that's not considered material underspending because it's so small in relation to the size of the NSNP. You can never spend the last cent. So as far as the AG is concerned, that's not the problem. We had an unqualified audit opinion for 2011-12 and 2010-11. We're very happy about that. I can say now to you honorable members, the audit opinion for the current financial year, 2012-13, is going to be quite a challenge. There are many things I have sleepless nights about. You can well imagine, I don't sleep much these days. But one of the many reasons I sleep this night about is that for the interventions, as I said, we don't get money, but we have to do things in the provinces. When there's a shortage of material, and there's a shortage of staff, a shortage of people, S&P and so forth, we have to do it overnight. We embark on emergency procurement and so forth. But when the auditor comes to audit you, they don't take that into account at all. They audit you as if you're a normal department functioning under normal conditions. And it's been very, very difficult. The CFO and I here have to play devil's advocate with each other all the time. She goes on leave, but she's never on leave. I go, I've hardly been on leave, but if I'm away from the office, you're never away from the office. Because you've got to make these decisions at accounting officer's CFO level. And it's not a normal environment. The PFMA is very strict in terms of what you must do. You have seen in terms of various issues raised, some people believe that you mustn't stick too much to the PFMA because if you do, you're being too bureaucratic and so forth. But as an accounting officer, it's always difficult, your challenge, because if you do something now, the service gets delivered. So nobody complains. But they'll get you at the point of your audit. And then they will call you to SCOPA, and you will get slotted. Other way around, you protect yourself now, so you get slotted for service delivery now. SCOPA doesn't call you. But so it's those issues that I'm saying now. It's very hard for an accounting officer operating under conditions of Section 100 interventions. Worse still if you've got two. It's generally hard in situations where you have emergencies. Things come up, even ordinarily if you don't have Section 100, about what you must do. You've really got to look at how you comply. So it's an area that we believe is going to be is quite difficult this year. But we've operated very, very strictly as far as we can within the bounds of the PFMA and definitely within the spirit of the PFMA. The emphasis of matter we got is that significant uncertainties in legal claims emanating from the actions of these publishers, Lingua Franca Publishers and Procon Fisher Pty Limited. Now, this is outside of our control. As I said, we are being litigated. We've been taken to court on the catalog on by publishers on a regular basis because of the work we're doing there. So this is an uncertainty, which, again, wasn't our doing. Then the Karigure one, as I've indicated, irregular expenditure. It was a matter raised last year for the first time. Even though this project has been implemented for a few years, and was reflected as irregular expenditure last year and repeated this year. So it's not a new thing. And then materially underspending, this is the infrastructure one. So these are the three emphases of matter that's there. In conclusion then, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, the strategic interventions for 2011-12 period will be consolidated during the coming financial year to improve learner performance, with a specific focus on learning. I want to just repeat that point, Honourable Chairperson and Members. There's a lot that's going on in the education sector at the moment. There's a lot that preoccupies us and preoccupies me. Our Minister, as the leader of the sector, has constantly said, I come back to our mantra, is we do what we have to do to the best of our ability to deal with the issues in relation to interventions, etc. But we must not lose focus on our core mandate, which is learning, which is learner improvement across the sector. That's what we're here for. We need to fix our financial management in Limpopo. We need to do that though so that we can have learner performance improving in the country. Working with provincial education departments, this focus on learning will include, amongst others, implementation of the CAPS, as well as monitoring curriculum coverage, something we've been doing for the first time. In the last year, under this administration. Consolidating the workbooks program through expansion as well as monitoring utilization and providing support for the utilization, enhancing teacher development and accountability, and then using the results from the annual national assessments and national senior certificate as key interventions to improve quality, to inform support to teachers. I thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, DG. The report, you know, I gave you quite a lot of time to speak to it because it was very important, because it was a thick report, you know, the report that was sent to us. And I like the way it was presented, you know, in a shortened form. What I'm going to do now, I won't speak to it at all because we gave you at least about 1.5 hours. You know, to speak to it. I think I'm going to open it for questioning by the members. Clarification, questioning. And let me put a limit for the time being on the questions. That we can have a second round. We'll make it 2 per person. And we get a second round. Because it's now 5-11. So let's make it 2 per person. Yeah?
Can I ask that, speak on the other one. Can I ask that you give me a second round because I have to rush to another meeting for a few minutes.
What must I do?
Reserve my space for the second round because I have to rush to another meeting now for about 20
now,
minutes.
How many questions have you got?
Oh, it's as the DJ said, there's a lot going on in the department. There's a lot of questions. But I'll probably come back.
Yes. Don't make it too long. But let us start. I'll start here with Honorable Makubela. And then I'll give it to Honorable Moni. Honorable Mponshana. You come for the second round. Fine, I'll be still busy. Honorable Dekobo. Honorable Madisha. Honorable Lovemore. And Honorable Smiles, in that order. All right. Fine. All right, you've taken his place. Fine. We start with Honorable Makubela. Make it 2 for the time being. And let's make it quick that we can have at least a second round or follow-ups or things like that.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks, DG, for the comprehensive report. You tried to deal with almost everything. And understandably so, because it's an annual report. It will be very difficult, Chair, as well, to question the report just in terms of few questions. There are many areas, including those areas that are happening currently, which you must be able to respond to. So in as much as we'll restrict ourselves to the year under review, but we do know that there are many going on, and the interest and temptation will always be there to want to understand how you are arresting the situation so that we don't get there. But let me restrict myself to the 2 questions, Chair, for now. The first will be with regard to a systemic approach to your handling the findings by the or from the AG, for instance. If you have got monthly monitoring mechanisms in terms of the spending within the sector, even within the DBE itself, but at the end of the day, you're not able to be responsive to some of those challenges dealing with them, when in fact you're supposed to have, say, an internal audit unit or division that tracks or keeps the department on track in terms of handling financial challenges that get you into those findings, in as much as you have an unqualified audit opinion, but we know there are challenges. The claim by the AG is that you used the private audit firms to handle this kind of thing, so you don't necessarily have an internal unit on your own. All I want to understand is what mechanism, other than using the audit firms that are private, to me, comparatively, that will have to be expensive, unlike if you have got personnel in-house to whom these private firms perhaps needed to transfer skills if the issues, challenges of capacity or skills within the department, so that we are able to deal with that. The last one, Chair, for now will be that in the department then and now, you would have challenges of other than just mud schools in the Eastern Cape or elsewhere, you will have challenges where learners will be under trees. So they don't access this infrastructure that is appropriate. In some instances, they don't even have schools per se. They're struggling to establish them. Lately, in almost all provinces, schools are being closed. And when you look at the procedure to close or establish a school, in some areas it may be dwindling numbers. When you go to those who are arguing that they need schools, you may find the numbers don't necessarily mean anything. That they can't necessarily deserve a school, probably. But they are actually causing the department to do that. How are we responding to all of these? Because as they put these challenges, you are under pressure to respond to those situations. People don't know what it has to happen in terms of auditing your finances and so on. They just demand a school, and they want you to put a school overnight so that they access learning and so on. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, I want to echo the same appreciation for the department's account for the financial year 11-12. My question might be a long one, but I want to have one question. We've been hearing assertions that there is a crisis in education. Some people have gone to the extent of saying education is a crisis in South Africa. Now that we are having this annual report, I'm sure it will be easy to assess as to whether there's a crisis or not in the department. Can the department confirm or refute? Thanks.
Honourable Member.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. For the record, I have 18 questions. But you say I must give two, so I'll oblige. The first question, Chairperson, relates to denality. You know, at the time that the concept was introduced, it was supposed to be a pilot, and for me, my understanding is that a pilot, you want to introduce a system, you start with it on a small scale, and then you expand it. And I expected that the idea is to have all our schools almost in a lead, if you like. I become scared when I hear the DG talking about, you know, matter has been reviewed. But also, the other thing that we have asked, I think we're doing it for the third time in this committee. And I think during the release of matric results, the media asked the same question, and I have an interest in this question. I want to understand value for money. And we have continuously said to the department, isolate the results and the performance of the Denalidi schools, give them to us so that we can know. If we say our pass rate is 67 or 68%, grown to 72%, what is the overall performance of the Denalidi schools? so that we can see whether this process, and the department has said, no, we have not isolated. We say, do it. We want to know, is there value for money? How are we doing? Can we, so that at the time that you decide what to do with it, you are able to have an informed decision. Now, I'm scared, because review may just mean we are dropping the concept altogether. But even scary is the fact that we have withheld money for Limpopo because of low spending. But, Chairperson, I think, again, it's very important. When you do this, the people who suffer are not the ones who understand. It is the learners. It is the learners. So I just want the DG, tell us something a bit more, and maybe, Chairperson, through you, later on, give the information that we need. We just want the concept of denality. How are we doing there? My second question, Chairperson, relates to the AG's report. AG's report, and I want to address myself to the irregular expenditure of 74.8 million. And we hear that it happened elsewhere. And our point of departure is that it is still state funds. It comes from the fiscus. It shouldn't have happened. You know, I could use the analogy of saying, you know, when we eat at home, mom prescribes how we should eat. So let's take the food and go and eat next door. Because there's nobody who's going to know it into how we eat. Well, the question here, I want to be assured. This irregular expenditure that happened anyway, could it have had some kind of corruption there? Could there have been some corruption involved, even if it was not within the department? That's that assurance. But also, I don't know, the DG is very, very clear that is the accounting officer for DBE, but unfortunately for now, also for Limpopo and Eastern Cape. And both, because of the intervention, and both provinces disclaimers. What are we saying? Thank you.
With that question that was asked by the Honourable Dikobo, this is spanning over two financial years, and I think it's important for the department to tell us why is it taking so long to resolve it, because it seems as though it is resolved now. Thank you.
Out of this 11 questions, let me give two only. Number one, let me complain.
Let me tell people to stop showing up with how many questions we have.
Just
because all the people here are Honorable Lovemore.
I'm following up. Well, let me start by complaining. Well, you see, we're in a crisis, educationally, the country, at this moment. And everyone knows, really. And one would have thought that, albeit the minister is not well, she couldn't make it, and we accept that.
Can I ask you a question? Are you answering on Romani's question, or is your opinion now? He postponed to a crisis. Continue.
Kindly may I go on?
Yes, you may.
Okay. That, albeit the meeting of the cabinet may be, you know, taking place at the moment, the deputy minister should have been here. Why? Because there's a crisis today in the country, insofar as education is concerned. One went out to check just now. Ministers who are outside, who are not in the cabinet at the moment. And this is a very serious problem that we're faced with at the moment, and kindly should look into that. But then we'll remain talking about that. Let it be noted. My question is small, number one. to the department. Are all pupils ready to write the examinations, the next coming examination? Yes, we know that in very many other provinces who were able to get books, etc., you talk of Limpopo. One can cite as well other provinces, but Limpopo in particular at this stage. They are going to be taken to the examinations, etc. Are they ready? I think we need to go into that. The visibility of the quality of assessment. If you say that we're to write the examination in the coming 2-3 weeks, together with the other provinces, are they ready? That's the first thing that we need to understand. Secondly, the auditors were here, was it yesterday, and they spoke inter alia about the HR problem, of course, including the underemployment of the numbers of people in the department, which in my own opinion shows that there has been no proper work done there, you know. Now, you say there are these challenges. You say that here we have not been able to do well, or here we have been able to do well, but enough people have not been employed. That means the auditor is the auditor general that says so. Why have you failed over all this period to make sure that enough members of staff are employed? Has that not contributed, for example, to your failure to make sure that at the end of this year, permit me to say, South Africa is going to get stuck and our children will not be able to go on properly? You said two questions. Let me wait there. And when he comes in, I'll be able to go on as well.
Thanks a lot, Honourable Matisha. Honourable Lansmo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have 7 pages of questions. Chair, I'm going to be as quick as I can. I hope, it being the annual report and one of the two most important documents of the year, that you certainly will have patience with that. Chairperson, I was accused, let's use that word, by Panyaza Lusufe yesterday of working with Section 27. If that's the perception of the Department of Basic Education or of the Minister, I'm very proud of it. I'm not working with Section 27. However, I am working towards the constitutional right of children to achieve basic education. And I certainly will continue to do so. Chairperson, I'm very concerned about something that the AG said yesterday, and I think that seeing that the DG and his officials were not present, it should be known that it was said to us. If the DG has not seen a presentation or has not seen a copy of the presentation given to us yesterday, I suggest that he get it. One of the items highlighted in red as needing serious intervention was our oversight role, the oversight role of the Portfolio Committee. I obviously questioned that. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee. I questioned that. The response from the Auditor General was that if there is no credible line of credible information coming from the department based on good management, good monitoring, etc., you cannot perform a credible oversight role. Therefore, your oversight role is in serious jeopardy as a result of the management failures within the department. Now, that is serious, and it certainly requires attention. The DG made a lot of reference to numbers, but didn't necessarily expand on the implications of those numbers. And let me just give an example. Litigation, 37 cases in the 2011-2012 year, not mentioning that in the year before that there were only five. So does that indicate that the level of dysfunctionality has increased? I should certainly think so. I know I've made a lot of comments. I want to ask two questions. The one is about targets. There are a number of different types of targets in the annual performance plan of 2011-2012, on which this report is obviously now based. There are targets that are shamefully low. And an example is that 30% of schools should find the support given to them by district officers acceptable. 30%. You get 37%, you say that's okay. Tick mark next to the box, or in the box. There are targets that are meaningless, like SGBs functioning optimally. How on earth do you measure that? There are targets that you cannot measure. You have different measurements, for example, for the number of libraries at schools. The baseline is very, very different from the actual. And then there's no indication of which is correct, which measurement is correct. So the point is that there must be in place targets which are meaningful. Let me give you another example of a meaningless target at textbooks. The target is that a certain percentage of the books ordered must be delivered to the warehouses. Not a certain percentage of the books required by learners must be in the schools. A certain percentage of the books ordered must be in the warehouses. And yes, you achieved it. I mean, it's 98 or 99%, meaningless to the children in the schools. So I didn't hear once that the DG indicated that that would be addressed going forward. It's critical, and my question is, will it be addressed? Chair, I've referred to textbooks, so let me refer to infrastructure. And I'm referring now to, and you don't necessarily have to go there, but referring to pages in the annual report. On page 75, and was mentioned by the DG, on page 75 of the annual report, the statement is made that an amount of 10 million rand was allocated to each province to address capacity constraints. That's with respect to the spending of the infrastructure grants. There's no indication whatsoever whether that 10 million rand actually had any results. Did it address capacity constraints? How did you employ people? Did you outsource? What did you do? On page 76, the school infrastructure backlog grant was an amount of 700 million rand. 2% was spent. 2%. A mention is made of various invoices that have been received and that hadn't been paid. That totals 112 million of the totals of 700 million, leaving 82% unspent. No mention was made of what will be done. The last one, Chair, that I want to refer to on infrastructure is on page 83, where one of the targets looked at was the percentage of schools complying with a very basic level of infrastructure. The baseline was 84%. The target was 88%. The actual was 55%. There's a serious discrepancy between the baseline and the actual. I don't know which one is actually correct. Clearly, one is wrong and one is perhaps correct. I don't know. My question is, do you? Page 83 of the annual report. The reference is made to the target of the percentage of schools complying with a very basic level of school infrastructure. The baseline was 84%. The target was 88%. The actual achieved was 55%. Now, how could the baseline have been 84% and the actual achieved by 2011-2012 be 55? It is 30% less than the baseline. So, as I say, my question with respect to that is, it is one example of a serious, serious discrepancy, and no indication is made that there is even a discrepancy, let alone what is being done to address the discrepancy. Are you addressing such discrepancies? So my questions then really go to the targets and what you are doing to address those to make them meaningful. And secondly, with respect to your measurement tools, using infrastructure there as an example, and the discrepancies that are arising and what you are doing to address those. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks for that. Honourable Marco Bela.
Chair, I did not want to be disruptive.
Yes, I know.
But I wanted you to be consistent when you give us a number of questions, so that we don't restrict ourselves and other people are at liberty to go on and on. Because otherwise that will then be the manner of doing things and it will be wrong.
Correct, yeah. But I think what was there was a few examples, but I thought that, you know, I'm coming around again to everyone, just to add in extra. Honourable Smiles, just make it two, please.
Very difficult to make it two, but...
No, make it two, please.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start on a positive note by saying the access to education is commendable. I wouldn't go into the credibility and the validity of the figures, but I think the point made by my colleague on credible information should be taken seriously. then, Chair, let me go to the concluding part.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on learning. While the focus on learning and is also acceptable, my question is, why is learner performance not indicated in this annual report? I mean, why don't we see the from grade R to grade 12 in 2011, how did they perform? Why is it not part of this? Because if learners, and they should be the focus, we should spend our money on learners. We must tell the learners with the 200 billion rand or what the amount approximately, this is what we bought for you. This is what you get. This is the value that you get. So I think the absence of that, of those learner performance, in the annual report, we should have that kind of, and I think Honourable DeCorbett owned into to Tina Lady schools only, but I think the broader picture is also important. Chair, then, can the department also indicate, as I said, the access at 99% or 98% is good, but let's look at the quality. Can the department please indicate why is it that with regard to quality learning and teaching campaign or the committees, only 3,000 out of 26,000, 25,805 schools, only 3,000 have those committees. What are we saying about quality? Where are we going with quality? Then also in the same...
Isn't the third one?
No, it's still quality, Chair.
Right.
It's still quality.
Mm. You put an N in between. Yes,
but it's in the same slide.
Mm-hmm.
The same slide. Then 8,470 schools were visited for IQMS, also a quality issue, out of 26,000. What is the department saying about that quality mismatch?
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Honourable Madisha, I'm giving you a question. All right. Honourable DeCorbo.
Chair, I should be singing the song for you. Are a jolly good lady.
No, I was criticized.
Okay.
Because people hide their questions. You know, they got two there, but they make quite a number of examples.
Correct. Mm. No, on a lighter note,
yes.
we were reprimanded by Honorable Mponjane when they lamented the issue of the drop in the birth rate. And now I hear the department says there is a pregnancy regulation. I haven't seen them. I'm looking forward to whether they are aimed at dealing with that problem. I don't know. But I want to understand here the concept of funding norms. The DG reports, for example, that at quintile one, they are paying 960 rand per learner. And then at a quintile two school, they are paying 880. I want to understand the rationale, because for somebody who doesn't understand our system, you may say that, oh no, because the other school will augment. Quintile two can augment, maybe from the parents, I don't know. But what makes the department think that it is cheaper to maintain a child in a quintile two school than in a quintile one? Because if the cost for a learner for me would be more or less the same, what is the rationale behind that? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable, before I come to you, is there a question that you would like to ask now? Or you're going to wait for the next round?
I can ask, Chair, even if it's not a lot. The one DG, I've asked even some time back, and I want to once more to answer that one. I don't want to have my own conclusions. I want to hear it from you. We talk of e-education.
Mm.
At times we talk of e-learning. Is it one thing? Is it the same kind of budget and so on? Because we can't use these words interchangeably as if either it's one or it's two different things, or the other has been abandoned and so on. There's some confusion there that needs to be clarified. The second, under this year, you saying you have changed 2,591 subject advisors. All in all, how many do we have in the system? Did we train others this year, for instance, to deal with the backlog? And is there any impact that is being done following this particular training? And so, because when we do oversight, there are challenges that we come across, and we yet to see whether this has a particular impact or not.
Thanks, Honorable Gina. And then I'll go to Honorable Mashishi last.
Chairperson, thank you. Let me also appreciate the report, Chairperson, of which is very broad. We see a lot of achievements, at the same time see a lot of challenges that the department is still faced with, of which, is something that we Chairperson, my first question will be on the database with the department. It can be broad, but I'll try to limit it. When we look at the database that we have in the department, we can talk of the database on personnel, like the employees, how accurate it is. Also go to the database for learners, because when we talk of all these databases that I'm talking about, it has got a huge impact on the budget. For an example, Chairperson, if we are not clear of how many learners exactly do we have at schools, for me it has a huge impact as we talk of schools, textbook delivery, workbooks and so forth, as to say. Can we be firm and say, really, what the numbers that you are getting here are the true reflection of what is it that we have within the system? Same thing when it comes to educators or the employees within the department. I know we always have a problem of leave management and all the forth, and it impacts negatively on the base that we have. If ever we can get that assurance as to say how best can we make sure that we cap this sort of now a style of having so many employees on leaves which sometimes are not even well captured, and having that huge negative impact when it comes to the funding of education. Thus, we end up having a very high number of teachers that are not in the system, whereas so much funds are being injected to the department, and at the end we'll be questioning the value for money, whereas there is a little bit of loopholes that we can just tighten up and sort of make a difference. Secondly, Chairperson, it's still on data, but on slide 27, did you talk of teacher supply and utilization of teachers? I think it's slide 27. Chairperson, again, I think that is a very important slide that is there in the presentation, because the issue of teacher utilization is a challenge, and maybe if the DG can even expand more on that one, where we say we've got a lot of teachers that are a little bit redundant in our system, and what is it that is going to be done about it, and even the mismatch of the qualifications, and we are seated with such a number of those teachers in the system. How best can we utilize the numbers that you have? Because really, I think for now, there are instances where we pay 2 to 3 teachers for one, in reality, for one post. So that thing needs to be well managed for us, again, to talk of the value for money when we look at the system as a whole. Lastly, Chairperson, I'll come on the second one. Are you allowing me to go to the third one?
Yes, I'm going to allow you.
Okay.
Because I came around with everyone's third question.
Oh.
Yours was quite long. I had to go to Smilestone.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Chairperson.
Everyone wants to ask questions today.
Chairperson, we are saying one other way we are going to see, you have said there were so many achievements that the department has come up with, and also the challenges are still there, Chairperson. And for me, I believe one of the achievements that we need to see is where we achieve or where we meet our learning targets. I think that is the bottom line of whatever. We can have textbooks, we can have so many things, cats and whatever, but at the end, our main objective is to see the learning taking place, our learners getting quality education and so forth. Thus, in the department, we're having even so many units that are there, like the one on planning, what is it, planning and...
I think delivery unit.
Learning delivery unit and so forth. Chairperson, the challenge that you are faced with in the department, mostly financial management, irregular and unauthorized expenditure within the provinces, also the productivity in the classroom, and I don't know, Chairperson, whether with all the initiatives that we have within the department, where are we not making it correct, Chairperson? I'm very interested in that unit as to say how far does it go, because really we cannot wait for the annual reports like this where we reflect as to say we still have these challenges, whereas we do have some mechanism which needs to help us and assist us. I know some of them are still new, maybe we are still getting to our feet and to say we are going to get there, but do we see the impact of that? Because even then, I'm still going back to the value for money, because if they are there, we need to see the difference. And if it can be highlighted, as to say, really, with the introduction of such units, at least we are seeing the difference, something is happening. I know we'll be tempted, Chairperson, as Honorable Makubela has said, and the way we have raised some of the other questions, we are tempted to question what is happening now, not even concentrating on the annual report, but some of the things, they emanate from the annual report. That is why we are questioning them the way we are. Let me stop there.
Honorable Mashishi.
Thank you, Chairperson.
you, Chairperson. Yesterday I asked a question about education infrastructure, and then you referred to me that I should ask this question today with the department. Yes. My question was, they were talking about the infrastructure that is a really concern in this country, and I said I'm agreeing with them. So my question is there any provinces or province that are doing well in infrastructure? As they indicated that they are underspending procurement, basic services like sanitation, electricity and water, where they also indicated that there are lack of skills. I just want to check if there are any provinces that are doing well in infrastructure. If maybe you can just table those provinces. And the second question is on school management. You talk of a total of 1,485 principals participated in advanced certificate education program. Can I get an indication of how many principals are left, and when are they going to be taken on board? And lastly, if you can allow me, Chairperson, on the e-education, they talk about 1,650 schools for a period of 3 years that got connectivity. I just want to check how many schools are being earmarked, and when are they going to be connected? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chairperson, yes, just maybe an extension to Honorable Masisi's question on the infrastructure. Can the department indicate, apart from ACD and the other units that helps with the infrastructure backlog, what other agents or resources are they applying to make the infrastructure backlog successful? Because, I mean, ACD was there, and I think there's a provincial development unit. Maybe it doesn't work on infrastructure. What other mechanisms and agents are there to assist? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I want to refer to the National Education Policy Act, which was referred to quite substantially by the Director General in slide number four. And I want to find out why, whether I'm misunderstanding it. It seems pretty clear why it actually hasn't been utilized. My reading of Section 8, which is of that Education Policy Act, is monitoring and evaluation of education. Now, my reading of Section 8 is that the Minister shall, and I trust that she has, direct that delivery performance throughout the country be monitored by the National Department, which indeed we accept is done. Section 8.4 requires the department to assist the competent authorities by all practicable means within the limits of available public resources to raise the standards of education, provision and performance. Now, I know that there is the Performance Delivery and Oversight Unit, which I certainly has been doing some intervention, but this seems very clear. It seems very clear that if, for instance, textbooks have not been delivered in Limpopo, or the level of quality education delivered in the Eastern Cape is exceptionally low. In terms of Section 8.4, my reading is that the department shall fulfill its mandate and shall intervene, shall assist, within the available resources to improve performance. So an A and a B, is that reading correct? And secondly, why was this not invoked during 2011-2012? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson.
thanks a lot for that. I won't be long, DG. Mine is on the allocation of the 960 and 880. You indicated that when it comes to Limpopo, they didn't use the norm. You know, theirs are lower. I'd like to know, is it only Limpopo, or are there no other provinces? Because present 20 years, there are other provinces that is not sticking to this norm. And then what is the department doing about it? Then when it comes to the concurrent function, we know that there are challenges that the person faces, the department faces, when it comes to the delivery of education. How do you plan to address that? Because we do believe that when it comes to our department nationally, even if you are working on policies, that you should look at that too. You know, have an input in what is happening in the provinces. Then my last one is on inclusive education. When it comes to inclusive education, I know there's an excellent report out now by the department. You know, I don't think it was handed out to everyone at the moment, because that go to the Committee on Children, on Women, Children, and Persons with Disabilities. And I just scanned it. So I'd like to know if, did you do an assessment to check if it has met the objectives when it comes to that white paper? Because there was always no synergy, you know, when it came to the national department and provincial departments. That's all. I'd like you to answer all the questions, please. I think you can, like, there are questions that are interlinked. You can just do a brief summary of all these questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will indeed try that, but also don't want to leave Honourable Members with the impression that I've failed to answer any questions as well, so I'm going to try and do that as best as I can. I'm going to answer again in the order in which members have posed their questions, starting with Honourable Makubela. In terms of monitoring and not able to respond and the internal audit unit, let me just at this point respond to Honourable Lovemore's point about officials being present in the AG's meeting. We did have an official present from the start and another one joined late on account of the plane landing late. That's definitely not a problem of the DBE. So we were present. I'd got sight of the presentation beforehand. I got a report of the presentation thereafter. I'm very familiar with what happened at that thing. I couldn't physically be here on account of my other responsibilities. But on that matter of the internal audit issue, the official did report to me that that matter came up, and that is why I've got handy a page here of our annual report, and I'm looking for the audit committee's report, which is on page 96. If honourable members can look at that, please, on page 96, you will see on page 97, paragraph 6, it says the directorate internal audit was not functioning effectively, but it says the directorate, which means it was present. So there's a difference between outsourced and present. So there was an internal audit function present in the department. Furthermore, it goes on to say that it was not led by a suitably qualified person. The chief audit executive at direct level with relevant audit experience was appointed, only appointed on 6th March 2012. The committee is happy to report that the internal audit function is now operating effectively and was able to complete its agreed audit plan for the financial year ending 31st March 2012. So it says a few things. One is that it wasn't outsourced. You outsource certain functions of the audit coverage plan. That just allows you not to employ too many people. For example, when we have big high-stakes tenders, we employ external auditors. They focus on that thing. They check. For example, every time we pay for a delivery for the workbooks, the external auditors check each and every POD. That you must bring in external auditors to do. Furthermore, when the department split, we happened to lose the head of internal audit. We went to higher education and training. We advertised. We didn't get a suitable candidate. So we therefore, it was headed, as they say, by somebody who wasn't suitably qualified. So I don't understand the thing that it was outsourced. We definitely had a function. It may not have been adequate, but we made a quick recovery on that one. And it concludes, the audit committee, which is independent, not us. It's not made up of DVE officials. It's an independent committee. It's not the AG also. They're independent of the AG. In fact, they check that the AG is doing their work fairly in the department. So that's what I can say about the internal audit thing. So I'm not sure what was meant by the AG when they raised that matter. And then the second question from Honorable Makubela about what about learners who are not in MUT schools. Again, there we have a term which we called inappropriate structures, which is not just MUT schools. So where children are studying under trees, where they're inadequate, etc., all those are included in the prioritization for rollout of infrastructure. So that definitely is covered there. And then schools being closed, we have very clear criteria, and it's important that you've got to ensure that you look at the viability of your schools. However, there's a very clear prescribed procedure that must be followed to that. You can't just close schools, and it's important that all provinces follow those criteria very, very carefully. You are absolutely correct, Honourable Member, through your Honourable Chair, that some people just want a school because they want it close to where they live, 40 learners. Now, you can't do that. It raises a whole range of problems when you have a school with 40 learners. We discovered in a province recently there's a school with like under 5 learners. And they get a minimum provision. Now it drains your resources, it drains your teachers, and we can't have that. So one of our big problems in the sector is policy compliance. Honorable Moaning, the question of a crisis in education. Again, you know, this issue has come up very often and sometimes used expediently, I would submit. That's not to detract from the fact that the challenges we have in education are serious. And I think we've got to sit back and soberly pose the question. Pose it not for expediency, not for scoring points or whatever. Pose it in the genuine interest of learners. And if you pose a question like that systematically, you've got to answer it as follows. Is the education system, in terms of where we come from, getting better or getting worse? That's a basic question we've got to ask. If you want to say it's a crisis in this administration, then you've got to pose the question, has the conditions in education got worse under this administration or better? I want to submit in both of those time periods, whether it's from 94 to now or in terms of this administration, things are getting better. There are huge challenges that we face. There are persistent problems like, for example, the quality of teaching that happens in the classroom, the extent to which we've eradicated infrastructure backlogs. But to say infrastructure provision has got worse is not borne out by data. Data confirms it's got better. To say access has not improved, I don't think anyone is in a position to say that now. The big focus is on learner performance. But you must remember that it is very easy to be silent when you're not measuring learner performance. So last year was the first time we measured learner performance. And through your Honorable Chair to Honorable Smiles, who raised the point about even though we say learner performance is important, it's not in the annual report, this administration has reported on learner performance to a huge extent. Annual national assessment is about reporting on learner performance. It's alluded to in this report, and it's got targets in this report. But you can't repeat the annual national assessment report and the grade 12 exam report in the annual report. They are separate reports, but there's a substantial report on learner performance, which is called the Annual National Assessment Report. That gives you details about
quality issues. And the baseline must be derived from there. So I repeat, we can silently sit for years and say, look, we're not going to focus on learner performance. And then when we measure learner performance and we see it's not where we want it to be, then we can assume it's a crisis. But I come back to the point. Crisis means, is it getting better or is it getting worse? Let's look at whether the administration has been sitting back. There's a recognition that there are huge challenges linked to the triple T. That intervention has been led by the president himself, repeatedly. In response to that, we've introduced the CAPS, NR, workbooks, annual national assessments, infrastructure provision, accountability. These are all interventions to improve quality in the system. Now, on that basis, we've got to assess whether progressively quality improves. For the first time, we're able to do what's important, and that's check curriculum coverage. Because we know if you don't teach, you are not going to succeed. Past surveys have shown that there's very little teaching in some instances that happens in terms of curriculum coverage. That's an objective baseline. It's not an expedient point. It's an objective baseline. Given that baseline, have things improved? It's out of that assessment that we said, let's embark on curriculum coverage. So the point is that not because I'm DG, not because there's a need to be defensive about this thing. I think what's important is to be realistic. Because the point is that if we reach a period of restlessness and we keep saying crisis, 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 it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's not going to serve anyone's interest to do that. I'm saying, by all means, if there's a crisis, let's say it. But let it be based on a proper assessment of what's going on. Not expedient points. But I'm going to come back to whether, in fact, some of these things are being made based on a proper assessment of key things. Bearing in mind, I will talk about targets and the relevance of targets and the technical need for targets to be properly formulated. I'm going to speak to those issues and assess whether, in fact, some of these claims are predicated on those very principles that are being articulated. So, Honorable Moni, that's my response there. Honorable Dikobo, in terms of Donna Lady, indeed, you should be getting those figures. I'm going to ask Mr. Mweli to respond to your questions on Donna Lady, but I just want to say that you indeed should get that information. We'll make it available to the department. You raise another point on irregular expenditure in terms of the 78.8 million. From my briefing, I believe that the AG did make this clear, and I'm going to make it clear now. And I think you use a very good analogy about even if you eat next door, you still eat for table manners. That's in fact what happened. This incident, this situation of procurement was procurement outside the department. That was done according to proper prescripts, and it was audited. And it was found to be no corruption or irregularity in terms of supply chain management. The only problem was that in terms of what the AG said in Treasury regulations, is it should have happened in the department's process, not outside. But clearly, the AG asked everyone, have, in relation to these procurements here, found no corruption whatsoever. And if my briefing is correct, the AG did clarify this issue yesterday, that there's no corruption at all here. So when they ate in the house next door, they were forced to eat in accordance with generally accepted table manners, whether they were outside or inside the department. Just following your very useful analogy, I thought. Honorable Madisha's question about the DM, let me just say that the DM really wanted to be here, Honorable Chairperson. I don't know what's on the agenda of the cabinet, and very often that drives whether or not people are excused from the cabinet. So we can clarify that issue. But certainly the Deputy Minister wanted to be here. Are all pupils ready to write the exam? I'm going to leave that question to Mr. Mweli and the feasibility of the assessment. HR problem, underemployment of people in the department, and whether that's contributed to people not being prepared. Clearly, you know, we explained the underemployment and vacancy issue. It was about sudden resignations, the difficulty of getting people quickly. But really speaking, you've got to look at the areas where the vacancy exists, and you've got to look at who performs the function. The preparation of learners in schools obviously is impacted upon what the DBE does, but ultimately it's teachers in classrooms. And therefore we've got to say whether the vacancy is impacted on how we support schools. And I think that impact was limited. We managed to contain it. Honorable Lovemore, I'm not going to respond to the question about the relationship with Section 27 and the right to education. I did respond to the point about AG's presentation. I do indeed have it. About the oversight role, yes. And then the implication of numbers and litigation having increased and whether that represents dysfunctionality. The Honourable Member spoke quite a bit about targets and our targets must be credible and so forth. Now, clearly, given all of that, that the Honourable Member put forward about credibility of targets, and the importance of targets. Surely you can't then conclude that an increase in legal cases from 5 to more represents dysfunctionality. I don't understand how that indicator would work, because we know we're in an environment now that's litigious, where there's a lot of malicious, frivolous litigation. Because if we think that way and say the number of court cases is an indication of dysfunctionality, you encourage, which is clearly a tendency currently, to litigate for whatever reason. And I'm not going to go into the reasons for it, but we know we're in a litigious environment. In some instances, we've lost, mainly because the problems were there in the province, like PPN in Eastern Cape. It's not dysfunctionality that has grown. It's been a problem that's there. That could have been litigated long ago. In many other instances, we won. With some instances, clarity that it was a frivolous court action that's been brought. So I repeat, it can never be true that an increase in litigation constitutes dysfunctionality. I can't be given this reward that if I sue you very often, it represents dysfunctionality on your side. Because we're free to approach the courts. Whether it's well-grounded or not is not the case. So I think it would be appropriate to apply the thinking around targets to that conclusion that was drawn about litigation. In terms of targets on and meaningless, you know, I think, let me make the overall point in agreeing with Honorable Lovemore, that the targets and the indicators, and the two are separate, we mustn't conflate the two, we can do much better on. The use of targets and indicators is a very new thing across the world. And across the world, people are experiencing challenges on it. Honorable Chairperson, I should point out to you, and we can make this available, this literature, that many countries that went hard on targets and indicators have actually receded, and they've made it much, much softer, understanding that, you know, the assumptions about how easy it is to formulate and then supply data on targets is not as it was assumed. Because you can get a country to start spending a lot of money and time purely in collecting data and setting up data systems to measure targets as opposed to doing what it's supposed to do. There's a lot of that written, and countries have retreated on that one. So it's important to bear that in mind, that we're quite new with this thing. But notwithstanding that, I think for our department and our sector, we've still got a long, long way to go. But again, then, it's about, you know, where do we pitch this thing? I think terms like meaningless, can't imagine, and so forth, I would say doesn't necessarily apply in this case, in all fairness. Yes, a target, a low target for districts is subjectively, on viewing it, considered to be low. But again, if we go to what the Honourable Member has said about the formulation of targets, you start with a baseline. And the baseline survey found that very few districts were supported by schools adequately. And you start from that baseline and you look at what you can do to adequately increase it. Obviously, provision of district capacity, these are all factors that come into it. So again, that's a critical one. Measurability of targets, I agree with the Honourable Member completely that that's a problem, that we must ensure that measurability is critical. I'm just trying to understand the note I got on the excess of workbooks. I think I asked Mr. Lewis to respond to it. I can't understand that note. But again, then, let me go to specific examples. I think it's important to repeat these specific examples that the Honourable Members raised.
because they were raised very, very strongly. If you look at page 75 of the annual report, which our attention was drawn to, about the 10 million rand, and there's no indication of results. Again, Honorable Chairperson, we can provide that information. But the point is, this is an annual report which cuts off at the end of March. We can't put into this annual report anything that exceeds that date. We can't. So, of course, between then and now, a lot has happened. Indeed, I can confirm now, which I did say in my presentation, that a lot of provinces have already accessed this facility. But they couldn't write it in the annual report. Now, some things come up in here where Treasury says, fine, use the 10 million, and we action it. But it's not, it's definitely not something that will have showed results by end of March. Again, it's an unrealistic expectation of the link between an action and a consequence. It's a very, very unrealistic expectation. Let's then look at page 83, which Honourable Member also felt very strongly about. Percentage of schools complying with very basic levels of infrastructure. That the baseline and the, if you look at the target, the actual is lower than the baseline. Now, that does seem to be odd and counterintuitive. I'm assuming, though, that the Honourable Member raised the reason for variance in the last column, which I would read. The baseline use was determined by using the National Education Infrastructure Management System, NIMS, and the target achieved was determined through a sample using the school monitoring survey. Now, we can't write an essay in that block, but basically what that says is that you use two different data sets, and that's always what happens. When you use one data set for the baseline, and there's a credibility problem with that data set, and you use another data set which you consider more credible, you then default to the next one, which we thought was explained in that square. So it's not as counterintuitive as it would appear, this thing. We can seek to explain more, but then Honourable Chair, this annual report is going to become very, very thick, which is my problem. So the Honourable Member concluded with the question, are we addressing these discrepancies? I do have considered that there are ongoing challenges that we and other departments have in relation to the formulation of targets and indicators. They, in fact, experienced internationally, and indeed, even Honourable Member Lovemore experienced it just now when she used it with litigation, when, in fact, that can't be done, because you're then creating a perverse indicator which will encourage the whole nation to litigate against the Department of Education. It's definitely not something you want to measure a department against. Let me then go to Honourable Smiles in terms of these questions. Focus on learning. I have indicated that this department, this administration, has published voluminous information on learner achievement. The point is it realistic to expect that when you deliver an annual report, you put all of that in here? My view is no. We've got indicators in here on learner achievement, grade 3, 6, and 9, and that's supported by a whole document.
On a point of order, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question, if you look at the annual report, most of the things are summaries, right? Most of them, even the ENA in itself is a summary. Now, I was indicating specifically to what is happening in grade R. We're spending money in grade R, so we need to know what is the performance there. And if it was published previously, I still maintain that we should have a view, a bird's eye view on what is happening. That's my point of order, Chair.
Now, I repeat, Honourable Member, you can indeed only cover a summary in the annual report because we then provide details. And again, in any country, what you do is it's counterproductive to report on each grade. We report on each phase.
Can I just say something? There's quite a number of these questions that came up where, you know, we had reports already in this committee and that we questioned it. And I believe it is correct, you know, just to put down the summary, the way you're putting it, because even when it comes to ANA, it's a very thick report that we received, you know, that was spoken to, that we questioned, you know, when it comes to diagnostic tool. You can continue.
And indeed, when we publish the September results, we will again go into detail on that issue. And as we improve credibility of results, we will supply details there as well. Then the next question is about QLPC and quality. And again, I think, you know, we have introduced the QLTC as a mechanism to improve quality. It is, though, a structure to bring together stakeholders, including parents, unions, and so forth. And we believe that helps to make schools a societal issue. And in that case, you've got to persuade community by community, school by school, to form a credible structure. It's not something the state just legislates and force people to do. So I think we shouldn't conflate quality improvement measures like ENA and its coverage and QLTC, which is a voluntary association of stakeholders. And indeed, in all provinces, all nine provinces, I must emphasize, the coverage of QLTC is not 100% by its very nature. So I think we can do better there, but, you know, as it starts, people start seeing the worth of this thing and they participate, unions and so forth. So it's a very important thing. It's been supported and given further impetus by NEDLAC, and certainly that will help. In terms of IQMS, 8,400 schools visited is not good enough. Again, I'm not sure on what baseline or criteria that's based. Schools are to be visited by districts and circuits, all schools. What the IQMS does is to come on top of that. And our approach generally is that from that mechanism, the schools must be visited once in 3 years or something like that. Now, 8,470 schools constitute a third of the schools being visited by this separate mechanism, not the districts and the circuits, the separate mechanism. To my measure, yes, we should maybe do better, but the assumption that that's woefully bad, I don't think has any basis in terms of realistic expectations. Honorable De Kovo then raised the point about...
Look, at the beginning, the SG indicated you will report specifically on the DBE, but you will also report on the whole picture in the country. So when that figure is there, whether it is only DBE's work, I still have the right to ask what is happening nationally. So, and I expect that the national figure should be indicated as well. This is the annual report. Thank you.
On our program, DG, for this term, we are going to discuss the IQMS fully, because we're supposed to do it in, I think it was April month or something, and we didn't do it. So let us just carry on, because we will have proper answers on that.
Thanks,
Honorable
Chair.
And then we can criticize it then again.
Now, let me just say that the figures we reported here is national figures. It's not DBE, doesn't have schools, so it's national schools. And the IQMS is a national instrument. If the question is how many schools have been visited, then, of course, it's a different data. But the question was how many schools have been visited by IQMS. The figure we're quoting is a national figure. And I'm still saying that you can't IQMS visit all the schools, realistically speaking. So that's my response to that one. But we will come back on what Chair, as you say. Honorable De Kovo, in terms of the school funding norms, I'll ask Mr. Padiachi to respond to that. Just to say, though, that in terms of policy, the school funding norms, original policy as it stands, is that we provide seven times more funding norms money to poor schools compared to non-poor schools. We divided learners into five categories, as the honorable member knows. And then we say the poorer school will get seven times more than the less poor school. Now, as the honorable member correctly raised on the chair, it's not because it's cheaper to run education for a non-poor learner compared to a poor learner. The reality is that in looking at inequality in the country, the assumption is that parents need to supplement that differential if they are less poor. So in other words, the quintile 5s have to supplement much more than the quintile 2s have to supplement. That's the basis of our policy in terms of dealing with inequality. So we don't have equal funding. We have equitable funding that's there currently. Now, Well, it's important that Honourable Member raises this thing because we found, Honourable Chair, that there isn't much to separate quintiles 1, 2, and 3 in terms of the capacity of parents. That is why we conflated those three categories. And all of them would be no-fee schools currently. So they would get the same amount. We're now trying to deal with other schools that can actually opt into the no-fee system as well. But the Honourable Member is absolutely right in his observation. On e-education versus e-learning, Mr. Mweli will respond to that. Subject advisors in the system, did we train them this year? We'll have to, Honourable Chair, with your indulgence and the Honourable Member's indulgence, Makubela, come back with accurate information on that one. I don't have it on the top of my head about the total number of subject advisors and how many have been trained. So my apologies for that. Comrade Gina raised the issue about the accuracy of database. Sorry, my apologies. Did I say?
Sorry, I didn't notice because I was taking notes, you know, about what had to come back.
I apologize.
It's okay, Honourable Member.
I apologize feverishly to Honourable Chair and Honourable Lovemore and all the Honourable Members. I'm very sorry.
I think you're becoming very flippant, although it's correct what Honourable Lovemore said, but your remark to her is flippant. Thank you.
No, I do register my apology to Honourable Makubela. Honourable Gina has raised a very, very important issue about records, leave records, personnel data, learner data. It's a huge problem. It's a problem, as she's articulated, there's huge financial and personnel deployment implications. The collection of data is a provincial function, and we've had huge challenges there because principals are encouraged, or let me put it this way, principals have an incentive to inflate numbers because they then get higher pay and so forth. So we've taken a few steps. We've done a learner number verification exercise, and that tells us whether there's any variance in school. We want to implement disciplinary action against people who knowingly misrepresent facts. We also introduce systems like SASAMS and LURIS. SASAMS is a system that can be used at school, either paper or ICT, that captures information in a manner that it becomes much more difficult to lie about numbers, especially if you extend it into learner unit record information tracking system, where each learner must have an ID number and a name. So if Bobby Subrayan appears twice or my ID number appears twice, you can't pick it up. So that's the kind of things we're doing. The biggest challenge there has been budgets on that question. But clearly, every year that goes by, there's a recognition that the cost of not having credible data far exceeds the cost needed to fix this thing up. So we have to do that. But we recognize that's a major challenge. It's an area of weakness, and we're really working very hard with the provinces. Teacher utilization there, double parking. Honorable Chairperson, we've set up a team in DVE who's actively going to be working with, has been working, and will work with all the provinces on teacher utilization. The Honourable Member is absolutely right. In, say, seven of the nine provinces, and now Limpopo as well, PPN is being implemented fairly well in terms of policy compliance if you look at it from a distance. However, when it comes to looking at it in finer detail, you will find that even though access educators are moved, they're not necessarily matched to the right posts. The right teachers are not necessarily moved. So what happens is you move a teacher, but you leave behind the mathematics teacher for whom there's no class. That mathematics teacher starts teaching English. So you've now got a qualified math teacher incorrectly utilized. Another teacher goes to the school where the mathematics teacher is required. And that's been the problem of PPN implementation at its final level. It gets worse with implementation because very often people think foundation phase anyone can teach. So Bobby Subrayan is in excess, don't know what to do with him or whatever, getting to teach foundation phase. But to me, I taught physical science in school, high school, but I wouldn't be able to teach foundation phase. It's very, very hard. I find it intimidating to even think of teaching foundation phase because you get children who can't read and can't write. And I got children who could read and write and high flyers. Now, you need skills to do that. And what people have been doing is putting teachers in there. And the teachers who come in there, because they haven't been trained, assume it's easy, when it's not easy to teach foundation space. So one of my members is raising a very important issue, which we're now working very aggressively on in terms of dealing with this issue. It's also linked to other issues, and I'm not going to spend time, I'm just going to flag it. We're talking about teacher supply, demand, and utilization here. Because we also want to ensure that the age distribution in the teaching profession is more even and that the utilization is improved. Meeting our learning targets, looking at how learning is taking place, and reference there to the Planning and Delivery Oversight Unit. I'll ask Mrs. Chebeka to respond to that. Honorable Mashishi, infrastructure, lack of skills, school managers. Okay, Mr. Pariachi will answer the question on infrastructure. In terms of the ACE program, yes, currently there's 1,800 that's being trained. That figure will grow annually. But on the chairperson, we're exploring a situation where we want to say anybody that applies for a principal's position must have been through certain training programs and demonstrated certain competencies. And in that way, the ACE will be rolled out for every prospective principal, including new principals, so that every principal who's practicing ought to have done adequate training at a point in time. That's one of the major weaknesses in our system. E-education, in terms of schools covered, 1,150. Mr. Pariachi will respond to that. Honorable Smiles, this follow-up question, apart from ACIDI and other units, which other agencies and resources are working there? In the department, in the DVE, all other components, especially my office, the provincial monitoring, budget monitoring office, all of them assist with infrastructure. But largely speaking, it's the ACIDI unit that's working on it. However, outside the department, there's considerable government effort in the form of the National Treasury's infrastructure capability, but more so the PICC now. That's a critical mechanism for ensuring that infrastructure delivery improves. Of course, the legislatures at provincial and national level assist as well. And then the clusters in the province and national level. So at the national level, there's a ministerial and DG's cluster that deals with infrastructure as well. So these are all the mechanisms. What the PICC does now is it brings them all together in a systematic way of dealing with infrastructure improvement. Honorable Lovemore, NEPA Section 8, the Minister shall direct monitoring and evaluation to be done. Honorable Member, consider that that's indeed done, and assist competent authorities to raise standards of performance and shall fulfill its mandate to intervene. This is all true and all correct. There's two other aspects, though, to consider in understanding the implications of this. In other parts of NEPA, it speaks to the procedures to be followed by the minister where she comes across problems of non-delivery. And the procedures is that she picks up the problem through monitoring. She writes the report to the executing authority, giving the executing authority an opportunity to respond and to show how they're going to remedy the situation. She then can table that as well in the legislature in the kind of reports that we do. So when we come here and we do our provincial monitoring reports, that's what we're doing in terms of the legislature. She would write to the MECs, and in CEM, she transacts that issue. All of that is done within the framework of the Constitution, of Section 100 and other related sections, of what can be done by the national executive, where there's a failure to deliver by the provincial authority in terms of its executive functions. Furthermore, there's the Intergovernment Relations Act that governs what it does. So I can't go into all that detail, but what I'm saying is this Section 8 should be read in conjunction with those things. But I do agree with Honorable Lovemore that in the letter and spirit of this provision, monitoring and evaluation becomes important. Critically, I think the point Honorable Lovemore is making is that we're at a stage now in education where the recognition of the importance of monitoring and evaluation and remediation of challenges is critical, and we've got to strengthen that. Honourable Chair, in terms of the school funding norms question you made, I'll leave that to Mr. Pariachi, and inclusive education to Mr. Mweli, with your permission.
Thanks a lot. Just hold on, please. Switch off.
Point of order.
Switch off. No, there's no point of order because there are questions that were not answered.
No, you raised the point of order, there was no problem.
No, but I just
review
the questions.
So there's no point of order.
No,
that I can raise.
Please, Honourable Madisha, I want to speak to that questions that were not raised. And then we can speak further. Because there's one from Mr. Honourable Tekobo, and there's one from you too that was not raised. Let us look at, I think, the Karakude. That one was not spoken to. So I think that you have to give to your CFO, that 74 million. The irregular expenditure, because I also added something onto it. You didn't explain that one. Then when it comes to the vacancy rate, I think the Honourable Tekobo brought that up, and that was not spoken to. Did you? All right, then it's fine, because I was writing a bit too, so I didn't hear all the answers. Thank you, Honourable Madisha.
Okay, the issue of the human resources, yes, I did raise that, but then I want to still insist that it needs to be looked into, and not just looked into, there needs to be a proper explanation, because like I said earlier, the auditors have looked into that, and they have reported that nothing has actually happened, and the DG has not said anything at all. Now, the second thing, okay, that I want the DG to report, because the entire country wants to know whether those hundreds of thousands of children of South Africa who were not given textbooks will be ready to go and write examination. That has got to be responded to. It's got to be responded to. Whatever anyone says, I insist that you know whether those children are ready, who have not been given books, who even today, about two, 3 weeks are going to be writing examinations, will be ready. And then if you say, because that's what I say, they are not ready, what is it that's going to be done?
Honourable Chairperson, I thought I did say very clearly that Mr. Mweli will answer that question. So I'll repeat now that Mr. Mweli will answer that question on readiness. On the HR issue, there's a distinction that must be drawn between HR in the DBE and HR across the sector. When we talk about the annual report, we're talking about HR in the DBE. I did respond to that. If I didn't respond adequately, a follow-up question can be posed. But on the readiness of learners, Mr. Mweli will answer all the questions in relation to school readiness, curriculum coverage, etc. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start with the White Paper 6. Indeed, your comments, Honourable Chairperson, are indeed right. We are evaluating our performance against the White Paper 6 policy. Not only are we doing that, we're also measuring our performance against the international protocols and the definition of inclusive education, as provided for by the United Nations. We are doing that with all other policy instruments in the system to assess our progress. So that report is ready. If you want it to be presented to the committee, I think we'll be guided by the DG, the minister, and yourselves, whether we should come and present it here. In respect of the state of readiness of learners, Well, talking about nine provinces, learners are at different levels of readiness. We are also busy at the moment to make sure that, and in fact, we are not only talking about grade 12, we are talking about all grades. The national strategy for learner attainment that we are implementing this year covers from grade R up to grade 12. So in respect of the nine provinces, learners are at different levels of readiness. And I can also say that when we had to sit for ANA, learners were indeed ready to sit for ANA. The assessment that we have made, independent of line functions, indicated that a lot has gone into making sure that the system prepares learners to sit for ANA. And then in respect of the learners in Limpopo, we have implemented the catch-up plan in Limpopo. The extra tuition, which was scheduled to take place over 2 weeks, was completed last week Friday. We are evaluating the implementation of the extra tuition. We are also going to look at the learning outcomes and learner performance of learners in Limpopo. And I'm sure when we are ready, we'll be able to indicate the specific level of readiness in terms of individual grades as learners move. For instance, in the Northern Cape, given the Olifant's Hook situation, there's a negotiation and the arrangement to get learners sitting for exams much later than it would usually happen. We're looking at the possibility of probably doing the same with learners who are affected in Limpopo. And I think I must also just emphasize, for purposes of just making sure that our records are correct, we are talking about grade 1, 2, 3, and grade 10 in particular in respect of Limpopo. So we're paying specific attention to that. We are quite confident that towards the end of this academic year, learners will be ready to sit for the end of the year assessment, taking into account that particularly learners in your general education and training band, they are engaging in continuous assessment and not just, the end of the year assessment taking 75% of the work as compared to grade 12. The issue of e-education and e-learning, I do concede that we use it interchangeably in the report, and I think going forward we'll manage that so that the audience is not confused about the nomenclature that we use, because the policy refers to e-education, and in the report we also refer to e-learning. So we'll manage that very well so that, but it's usually used interchangeably. Sometimes you use e-learning, sometimes e-education. But essentially means application of ICT in teaching and learning. The number of subject advisors in the system, unfortunately, Chairperson, we don't have the figures readily available now. The difficulty is that this input comes from PEDs, and we'll have to get it from provinces in order to give you the exact figures. As to how many have we trained, I can say that we have trained the subject advisors, all subject advisors for the foundation phase, and all subject advisors in the further education and training band responsible for grade 10 as well as grade 11, and all subject advisors responsible for the intermediate phase, because that is the infrastructure that we use to cascade training to teachers. The impact, it might be a bit early to confidently talk about the impact now, but experts are indicating that, because we've also been training universities, by the way, the 23 universities in this country have been participating in our training sessions, as well as teacher unions. And they are indicating that over time, including Umalusi, that our training in CAPS is likely to improve learning outcomes and learner performance. That's about impact, Chairperson. In terms of the Dinaledi information, Honorable Dikok, I really don't know what happened, because we did provide this information from the first quarter of the financial year when we had to report on conditional grants. The information is readily available. I think the DG and the HOD for Western Cape were actually leading the analysis in giving us guidance as to what really happened. And I can tell you that if we compare the performance of 2011 and 2010, the Dinaledi school's performance has gone down to the extent that both Edcom and CEM said we are not getting value for money. And that's why DG referred to the reconceptualization of the way we're carrying out the project. But it doesn't mean that we are going to get rid of the concept of Dinaledi. We're still pursuing the concept of Dinaledi. In fact, we want to broaden it to benefit the sector much more than it's been happening now. But the reality is that we have not gotten value for money. The amount of investment that we put in this project does not equal the output. That's why the reconceptualization. So the information will be made available as the DG indicated. The issue of connectivity, again, we don't have the exact figures in terms of how many schools are still outstanding. I think it was a question asked by Honorable Mashishi. We'll have to get you that information from provinces. I must also indicate that it's usually driven by the amount of financial resources that are invested in this exercise. It depends largely on budgets that are made available by provinces, you know, to increase connectivity. But we could get you the information as to how many schools have reached the connectivity level, what kind of connectivity are we talking about? Is it for administration? Is it for teaching and learning? Is it only connectivity at the level of, you know, communication with the principal or not? That information is available. I think I have attempted to respond to the questions that the DG had requested me to respond to.
Just your follow-up quickly.
Thank you, Chair. Just a follow-up on subject advisors. We appreciate that the department does not have the actual numbers. But how do you ensure that, or there is there a mechanism to ensure that those subject advisors are appointed of the required quality? Because we have got examples, Chair, of failing principal or principal who are failures in the school. They are made subject advisors. Just last week, you know, we had such examples in some of these provinces. Because we are not interested in quantity, the numbers, just numbers, but the quality. Is there any way you ensure that your counterparts in the provinces appoint people of good quality or just get the numbers? And also, the link to that, Anna, we had the representative from the department eloquently saying everything was ready, but the first day of Anna in some provinces was chaotic. Some schools did not get their papers. They were asked to go and duplicate those who did not have. And are there ways of tightening these things in the future? Because we have presentation by the department, but the reality is always different. Thank you. Yeah, Chairperson, is another dimension, but nonetheless, the issue of the appointment of personnel in the sector follows the minimum requirements and the criteria set. And we always remind each other that we keep to the minimum requirements and the criteria that is set. If there's any mishap, then if it's reported to DVE, the DG and the minister deal with it as best as they can. As members will understand that these appointments have been far from Pretoria, but with, you know, all the
challenges around making sure that we monitor and so on, these things are indeed being addressed. I'm not sure whether the ANA one, should I leave it to, for Mr. Padayaki, because he's going to respond to the ANA issues. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I would start with the ANA. I think the committee had requested a full report, which we've submitted, and if it's not, we'll make sure that it's here in terms of the entire administration for this year. But clearly, there was a process in place where there were shortages or copies that were needed that would have been followed, which is why one of it was that there was emergency pack in districts, which in certain instances then that was made available to the schools, and where that was not sufficient, there were districts who had to assist in making copies, and then we also have to indicate that there were other schools which assisted in making copies on behalf of our schools. But clearly, the process of the administration, if I have to quote my DG, was chalk and cheese from the 2011, and that all our children basically sat, and where they couldn't sit on a particular day, arrangements were made for them to sit on the next day. In certain instances, a school may have written the paper that should have been done the next day. Even there, we've had officials both from the DBE and the districts who secured those papers and sealed them and then put them in the safes. So in that respect, we do not deny there weren't issues, but clearly that didn't jeopardize the entire running of DANA. So we will look into those issues, and we are into the second year, and in our third year we will get there. Then on the question that what is DBE's view on who are the provinces that best manage infrastructure, if you had asked me this question 2 to 3 years ago, Limpopo would have been on the top, would have been number one. But today, sadly, I cannot say that, but we're looking at addressing that. But in using the guide that we have used in terms of appointing implementing agents for the SCD, we have appointed and are working with provinces who have capability and we have confidence. And these are basically the Free State, Gauteng, and the Western Cape, where we have actually memorandum of agreements in order to do delivery on our behalf. And I think even in their own infrastructure programs in the EIG and equitable share, I think their reporting does testify to their ability. Then on the funding norms, basically it's been about 10 years since we introduced the funding norms, and the DG has indicated that, you know, there's a degree of from the poorest to the least poor that we have allocated funding. And we've had a review of this, and that is why the degree of poverty between quintile 1 to 3 and even in some schools in quintile 4 and 5 in some provinces, there's not much. And that's why the review process looked at equalization, which in 2013 basically we do realize to a certain extent with the additional funding from National Treasury. So in that respect, what we're moving to in 2013, we're going to be at 1,000 rand, just over 1,000 rand, for all no-fee schools. Now, in linking to the Honorable Chair's question as well, is that what we have is that Gauteng had done the equalization already. The other is that we had requested from Treasury a bit in terms of addressing the fee-paying schools, and also to, and this will then create two categories. We will actually not have quintiles as such, although we could use it for other purposes. We'll have no fee and fee-paying. And if that funding came through, then that would take care of the schools that were in quintile 4 and 5 who have not volunteered to become no fee. Now, what we faced with is that provinces, in addition to Gauteng, have indicated that they will be able to equalize from 1st of April, but there are three provinces that will not be able to do that. That's KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, and Limpopo, due to their financial issues in terms of their budgets. So that has been made clear to us. And in addition, Northern Cape has followed process in terms of the funding norms to indicate that they will not be able to achieve that in 2013, but in 2014. And we will ask, what would we do about it? Now, due process is not followed. then we have to track that money and try to make sure it's used for school funding norms. But a province can indicate before the appropriate time that in following processes that you will not be able to allocate, so schools can plan appropriately. The other issue we're facing, which we have to address, is the adequacy of these amounts. Because the 1,000 rand covers the issues related to services, and the services cost of electricity and water in itself has the increases have outpaced the increases we give in terms of CPIX. So these are matters that have not gone away, which we will still have to attend to.
One question which was not answered, and I might just say that I'm actually asking it tongue-in-cheek because of what I've seen in the provinces, and Limpopo is an example. I asked the DG to say something about disclaimers in Limpopo and Eastern Cape, and I must say this, you possibly, some of you might have seen this in the news. TV was out at a school, you know, showing lack of resources and all those things. And it has actually become a constant chorus in the Limpopo province where departmental officials go on national TV and say that these problems are caused by administration. I'm trying to understand what is happening. You have your headcom, you have your CM, but you can still have people who think, well, maybe taking advantage of people who don't understand. We can't remember now what came first. Was it administration and then problems? Or was it problems and then administration? But I really want the DG to say something because some of it happened during his watch.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I will respond to Honorable Ginner's questions on the planning and delivery oversight, or planning and delivery oversight unit. Firstly, just to say the report that was presented here, as we all know, covered the period up to March 2011. And what was reported, 2012. And firstly, some of the issues that were covered there were the establishment and the resignation of the chairperson, the head of the unit, as well as the decision to focus primarily on the 15 underperforming districts. We can report, although that was not the focus of the report, we can report that certainly a lot has happened, and we are hoping that at the end of this current financial year, we can report gains that have been made as a result of the planning and delivery oversight unit's work. Just to cite a few, firstly, it is as the unit had been established to identify key challenges to performance, the identification of those challenges which have revolved around credible planning and implementation, as well as utilization of data for planning. The DG said our focus as a department is learner performance, learning and learning outcomes. Those have converged in the work of the delivery unit primarily around the 15 underperforming districts. And as I'm saying, we are hoping that there will be visible improvement as a result of the work of the unit. But certainly, it is how those findings of challenges in the system have been used to inform planning for all of the districts across the country. The DG, in his report, talked about how we've institutionalized a district forum which the minister chairs. And that has really shown that there's improvement in the system in terms of coherent planning, in terms of implementation on all of the issues that have been identified. The next meeting of that forum is the 28th of October, where the focus is on planning credibly as a system for 2013. Thank you, Chair.
It covers all the original questions. There's a follow-up from Honorable De Klobo.
Yes,
sorry, not a follow-up. I didn't answer the question in the first place. We're likely to get into another debate on this matter, but let me say it in response to what Honorable Kikobo said. As I clarified the last time, it's just a fact. It's not trying to avoid responsibility. But I'm not the accounting officer of Limpopo or Eastern Cape. There are accounting officers there. They are the administrators. In terms of the PFMA, an accounting officer is the head of department. If not, it's somebody that the provincial MEC for Treasury appoints. In both these instances, we have that. That's a fact. It's not me trying to avoid responsibility. However, the issues are important. And what the honorable members raised is that, yes, the disclaimers are there. There are ongoing challenges in the schools, and the intervention is intended to fix that up. The question is, are we making progress in fixing it up? What you do is you send an administrator and you send in skeleton staff. You can send in four. We've been sending people to go there on a regular basis. But you don't take over all the personnel. You don't take over the teachers, the principals, and so forth. And some of those underlying problems continue. Some of the issues that are raised now as intervention problems are obviously, you can just, I mean, you know, it's clear that they were there before. And that's why Section 100 was declared in the first place. If there weren't problems, there wouldn't have been Section 100. So I think the success of the intervention must be measured in terms of what was found there, what were the reasons for the intervention, and is there progress being made in key areas? I should also add, in terms of the Constitution, in terms of the law, Section 100 must be focused on specific areas of failure. So you deal with those specific areas in a particular problem. And you've got to have a turnaround and show progress in those specific areas. So, for example, in the hospitals in Limpopo, there's still problems of medicine stockouts and that sort of thing. And clearly, the Department of Health at a national level, it's their watch, they take responsibility for it. But again, it's about what is being done to address that problem at this point in time, similarly with us. So that's the issue. In terms of the disclaimers, we're working very hard in terms of the audit turnaround plan. But remember, if you go into Limpopo in December, and the reason for the intervention is because there's been widespread financial mismanagement, to have fixed that up by the time you submit your annual financial statements, end of March, is virtually impossible, because the problems that have contributed to the disclaimer have happened already, and that can't be turned around. The point is, when we submit now at the end of this financial year, has there been an improvement in the financials is a question. In the case of Eastern Cape, honorable members will know that we've withdrawn from Eastern Cape for quite a few months last year. And in that time, you know, the province was administering itself. Up to now, the accounting officer is the accounting officer, the Eastern Cape acting head of department, not the minister's appointment. So again, there we're working very hard. We've appointed the ex-CFO from the DVE, Mr. Philip Bernardi, to work with that department. And we can see progress in this financial year. But in last financial year, obviously, there were problems that were difficult to deal with. And Honorable Dikova did say it was a tongue-in-cheek question. But he's right. I mean, it's not entirely tongue-in-cheek. It's an area that we went in there to deal with, and we must deal with it. Honorable Chair, I didn't respond to one question from Honorable Lovemore because I couldn't find it. I've now found it. If I can draw honorable members' attention to page 63 of the annual report. And what Honorable Lovemore indicated is that we had an indicator, which he illustrated as an example of a poor indicator, which spoke about the distribution of workbooks to warehouses. I want to draw the attention of the Honorable Chair to that column on page 63. It makes no reference to warehouses at all. In fact, the books were distributed to schools. And maybe we should have added schools there, but I think we assumed it was common cause that we distributed the books to schools. What we distributed to warehouses was surplus books. So it's not really an example of a bad indicator.
Furthermore, point of order, Chair, first of all, my apology. Absolutely, it doesn't say warehouses. I obviously got that from the whole Limpopo issue. But I don't want the DG to use that to say it is not an example of a bad indicator. The indicator is still workbooks as per the order distributed. Please don't lose sight of that. It doesn't say anything about the number of learners as per the order distributed.
Honourable Chair, I could finish. I was going to my second part of my response. And I want to contend it's not an example of a bad indicator. And I think the addition here doesn't negate what I'm saying. Now, as the Honourable Member Lovemore said, that if you put an indicator down, you must be able to measure it. At the time that we had to write this indicator, the only source of measurement was assigned TOD. We could have said number of learners using the workbooks, but we had no source to confirm that. Now, in the subsequent indicators, we've now got an independent survey which then looks at utilization of workbooks. And that is a good indicator because it looks at data. You cannot, as the Honourable Member said, put down an indicator for which you do not have data. We put down this indicator because we're sure for this one we'll have this data. And it's not a problematic indicator. It's saying at least we have data on whether in terms of, and the order is determined by data, remember, by what provinces tell us they have in terms of learner numbers per language per subject area. Have we distributed according to that? Given that information available at the time, it's a sound indicator, I believe. So I want to submit again that we believe is a sound indicator given that time. And I'm emphasizing this thing because when you formulate an indicator, you must look at what data is available. Otherwise, you report based on data that's not available. But the key point the Honourable Member was making, subsequently now, we have access to these surveys. So that's the point I thought we would add.
No, thanks for that. Because I remember when we were in Limpopo, they were still working on the PODs to come through. And I think the Honourable Gina brought up that, you know, being correct, etc. Thanks for that. Let me start concluding, because I've got quite a number of things here. DG, when it comes to the Dina Lady Schools, I remember we did have a discussion on it, but we'll, according to our report, we'll tell you what would we like to have on that. So it's not necessary to take it down because it could well be minuted. Because we have to first go through the minutes. Then you have a framework for the LTSM policy development. I think don't make notes because Llewellyn has everything. We'll just look at what would we like to have from you. And then the National Guidelines for School Libraries and Information Systems Services and the implementation plan, I think that's going to be important. Then with the IQMS, I made a mistake because we postponed it twice. But we are supposed to have it in this term. You know, before we close, that we can oversight you on it. Then when it comes to QLTC, I'm not sure, perhaps you can have a meeting on it with something else, but we'll have to look for a date. The pregnancy story, the regulations, I think that's going to be important for us because there are anomalies when it comes to the different provinces on what we are hearing. Then we always had a report on the infrastructure, the city, but I think we should have a consolidated report, you know, on a, you know, when it comes to the PICC. Because we have the PICC on the one side, we have the CD on the one side, and then I think it's the Mandela projects, the 94. The white paper, we are still going to tell you what would we like to have there, because I think it will be important for us to have that report that you were supposed to give to women, children, and persons with disability, and they said they will be calling in the department very soon. The UNA evaluation report, I think it will only be next year because your results will be out, everything will be concluded in December. And the concurrent function, we'll have to address that when it comes to concurrency. And we never, ever in this committee had the report on the interventions because it normally goes to NCOP. And normally when you speak in NCOP about it, then we are busy on the one side. And then the AG said when it comes to the sector reports that it will be ready this week. And I think there is a plan meeting for the committee when it comes to sectors. DBE plus the sectors. It's going to be important for sectors to be present in that meeting to speak to their report. DJ, are you getting so hot? Oh, you got flu.
I've been evaluated to have oily skin by,
oh.
By the beauticians.
Now it's okay. And then something happened before the meeting. Llewellyn, that's all so preoccupied, you know, going through reports, gave me the report on equal education as a briefing note, a submission they made. And it's quite thick. Then my secretary, my own secretary, brought another submission that came through from equal education, but it is shorter. And I think when it comes to this, let me read through it with the help of my researcher and content advisor. And let us treat this report the same as we treated the report of, I think it was the Legal Center from the University of the Western Cape on disability. And let it come back to the committee. It won't perhaps be in your presence. Perhaps, you know, you have an entity. Then the committee can just speak shortly to it. And perhaps you can call in Equal Education to make a 10-minute presentation. And then we'll see, you know, with a submission, as we did with the University of the Western Cape, how can we filter it in to our recommendations? But then we'll have to speak to you two about it. You know, because we can't just have, you know, one-sided reports that have to go into our recommendations. And on that note, I would like to thank the department. I think it was a very hot meeting because everyone wants to have their say. Because, you know, normally, we like playing to the press. Because normally when, I think, I'm not sure whether this meeting was taped for DSTV. I'm not sure. But normally they tell me. But then I don't tell the committee members. Let it just play itself off. Because we already had a meeting in this room where it was on DSTV. And I just, they told me and I just kept quiet and let the meeting just go on. And let everyone just do their speaking. And, you know, and let everyone see, you know, the way we react with in committee meetings when it comes to different things. And then when it comes to the report itself, we do have an analysis on the report. And then we'll go through the analysis again and see whether we're satisfied with what the department told us, because I think that's going to be important before we conclude your whole annual report. And members, remember that tomorrow it will be the ELRC, and I hope each member, as you're sitting here, have the analysis when it comes to ELRC. And then I think that will be 9:30 tomorrow. I'm not sure of the venue. And the same venue at 9:30. And I'd like to thank the department for bearing with us and, you know, answering everything that was asked, requested from you, and there were interjections, and I'm not going to accept the interjection now because I gave you a chance. You know, because you were out that you
could promised me a second round.
No, I gave you a chance and you came in, you know, that you can speak. And I was so happy when no one interjected and said because you spoke, they would also like to have a chance. We just like, you know, the school when it comes to education. Everyone may ask a question and everyone should receive an answer. And I thank you, members, because you kept in my toes today. Normally, I have to write in between, like I said to the Honourable Lovemore when we were in the Northern Cape. Normally, I should take notes of everything being said in a committee meeting. But when you're chair, it's very difficult. And therefore, sometimes, you know, you don't listen to the questions or answers given because you're looking at what do we want from the department when it comes to our conclusion. Thanks a lot, members, for your presence. And then I think DPE have to just leave, you know, because we're having the entity tomorrow and we're having Umalusi next week and we're having SAIS again. The person in DBE that's in charge of entities have to be in the meeting, chief director, including, one of the deputy directors. Yes, directors general. That is very important. Thanks, DG.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I'd like to thank the honourable members for a very productive meeting, I thought. I just want to say that tomorrow is my birthday, and I expect that when you send me very warm birthday wishes, if I don't respond immediately, please understand that I'm busy. I will respond in time. Thank you very much.
I'm going to go to the next one. Thank you. he's the DG. Okay.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much. And the soft copy? Yes. Great.
Can I?
No problem.
Yeah, no, I'm taking it.
Many people are anxious when it comes to this meeting because you don't know what to expect. But I'll tell people in as soon as the people is talking about. Thank you.
Thank you. So if you switch it off, does it automatically save it?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
See, Christian Belinda. Okay. Let's say saving.